Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here again to talk about stuff this week on the show. We get to talk about a good Spider-Man movie.
What good Spider-Man movie is this, 2004, Jonathan?
It kind of feels like it. Spider-Man Homecoming is here. We feel like we've been waiting for it forever.
Yeah.
Was it worth the wait, Sean?
I think so. Yeah. It is a bundle of fun.
It is a bundle of... That's probably the best way to describe it. It is just a... It is as fun as movies get.
Yes.
Loved that. I'm going to talk about another couple of movies. We're going to review the new episode of Twin Peaks, obviously, which was not as weird as the one before it.
I mean, if it was, I don't even know what we would do as a species anymore.
But I will say, I think people are because of just treating it like relative to episode 8, people are downplaying what was weird about this episode, because plenty.
Yeah, no, it was a normal episode of Twin Peaks: The Return, which is not normal in any way whatsoever.
No. So I'm so excited we get to talk about both of these things.
Yes.
Why don't we go ahead and start with a bit of stuff. Sean, what have you been up to?
I've been up to a couple of things. I guess first up, I've started watching the Hannibal show that finished.
Awesome.
A while ago. Yeah. Because that's all on Amazon Prime Instant Streaming now. So if people have Amazon Prime, you can just watch it. I just watched the first two episodes of season 3, so I've kind of burst through it pretty quickly.
So
that show's really fucking good.
You've seen the best episode of that show, which is the season 2 finale.
The season 2 finale is pretty fucked up, yeah.
That is as Lynchian an episode of television that David Lynch has never directed.
Yeah, yeah. It is definitely a good companion piece in some ways to the new Twin Peaks.
I mean, you agree with my assessment that there is no show in TV history as influenced by Lynch as Hannibal, probably.
Yeah, no, it's definitely all the weird stuff with the deer going throughout the show and everything like that is...
And a lot of other avant-garde traditions. Yeah. Like, it reminds me a lot of how Twin Peaks The Return uses a lot of film history in its language.
Yeah, and the ways it uses your knowledge of... Or, like, because, like... One thing I'm really curious about is what it would be like to watch this show if you knew nothing about what it was, nothing about what Hannibal was, because I think this show is so built on this, assumption that the viewer has at least seen Silence of the Lambs or knows enough about Silence of the Lambs to, understand that.
It
pulls from that visually and, plays with that visually so much.
Well, and have you read the Thomas Harris books?
I've read the first half of Red Dragon, and I didn't like it that much.
Oh, really? Okay, because I think Silence of the Lambs is okay, and I couldn't get into the other ones. I think Red Dragon is great. And I think it is so interesting that it is, with Red Dragon in particular, the show is so in conversation with that novel and with ideas from it. That's fascinating to me. But it's also in conversation with the other versions of Hannibal, as you say, and these things. It is a heavily metatextual work, and it's one of the things I love about it.
Yeah, no, it's really good. It is also... I had to, after watching the first couple of episodes, I had to, go on the internet and clarify, this did air on NBC, right?
See?
Right? This is not a Showtime or HBO production, right? Because
it's...
Holy fuck shit, is this show gruesome.
It's the most violent thing I've ever seen on TV.
Yeah, it's, one of the most violent, if you put it in with movies, I think it's up there in terms of, just how disgusting it is.
They mostly got away with it because the show was mostly funded by a French company, Gaumont, and then NBC basically just licensed it, so it's really a French show. That's another thing it has in common with David Lynch, is he gets most of its funding from France.
Yeah, because it turns out, American financiers are not going to, look at Hannibal and be like, well, that seems palatable to a mainstream audience.
It's also the thing of, it's the thing I love about Brian Fuller and that show is I don't think a straight person would write that show.
Sure.
Because it is so engaged with ideas of homoeroticism in this relationship. And it is one of the things about having, I think, someone like Brian Fuller, who is openly gay and a genius, and out, and I think one of the few showrunners out there who's kind of elevated that position. And it's one of the things that I think... And you haven't even really gotten into all that yet, because season 3 goes full bore on it.
Okay, good.
So, yeah. And season 3, the opening stuff in Italy, they really go on a limb. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful, weird, just utterly disgusting show.
I'm so glad you're watching
it. Yeah. In particular, season 1, because the show is a lot more serialized than I thought it was, based on hearing stuff about it. Because I think what people talk about, they tend to talk about, the core relationship between Hannibal and Will Graham, because everyone always has to say his full name on that show.
They love
100% of the time. It's every single character, nobody has ever just called him Will. It's always, are you talking about Will Graham? Will Graham. Hey, Will Graham.
It's one of my favorite ticks in that entire show.
Yeah, it's really funny. It's really endearing in a weird way. Because it's a very good full name, and it's very fun to say the full name Will Graham. So I get it. But yeah, so like most people, I think, kind of talk about that side of the show. And I hadn't heard that much about how particularly season one is like kind of like a killer of the week show. Season two is not fully that, but it's still kind of that.
Season two is a weird satirical mocking of that in a weird way.
Yeah, and so that was something in season one I really enjoyed, was just the... that it had that almost like X-Files-ish kind of thing of like the beginning of every episode, you're like, what the fuck is this one going to be? It's just like, what is it? And then it's like, okay, this is like a body like that's made out of a tree. This is like bodies that are just like a field of mushrooms. This is like... You have to imagine, like, everyone involved with the production just went home and had nightmares for, like, 3 weeks after making each individual episode. Like, all the way from, like, the writers, the directors, to the people that have to, like, make all the fucking bodies. And then the actors that have to, like, act next to, like, the most disgusting shit in the planet. It's really good.
I don't want to spoil anything. There's a main character who gets killed in the second season, and what happens to his or her body.
Yeah.
That actor... I don't know if they're ever going to live that down inside.
Yeah, yeah. That's the shot that reveals that is really good.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fantastic show. So if people have not seen it, all of it is on Amazon Prime Instant Streaming. So
that Mads Mikkelsen, man.
Yeah, he's very good.
And Hugh Dancy, too, obviously.
Yeah.
Who is a much bigger presence in, like, the first season. Mads Mikkelsen grows in stature. Yeah, I love that show. I've been watching a show on Amazon.
Okay.
It's kind of a weird segue. So... while we're waiting for news on who is going to play the 13th Doctor on Doctor Who, the one name that keeps surfacing in rumors I've been hearing is Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah.
And just because I keep hearing that name, and the thing she's associated with is this show that... it was a BBC show aired over here on Amazon streaming called Fleabag that she wrote and stars in, based on a one-woman show she did in England. And so I was like... well, you know, who knows where rumors will go with Doctor Who, but I want to watch this show, and if anything comes of that with Doctor Who, it would be cool to have experience with this actress.
Yeah, it's just it's a convenient excuse.
Yes.
We need those sometimes.
And I also wanted to watch the show.
Yeah.
And it's only 6 episodes long. I've watched 4 of them. I probably could have finished it, but I actually do think it's a show that you need to sit with each episode. I would not want to, like, binge multiple episodes of this thing. It's a phenomenal show. And it's really interesting. It starts as sort of like... in this wave of shows we've had in the last few years, like Lena Dunham's Girls or Broad City on Comedy Central or any other number of these we've had of like young women in the big city, kind of sexual misadventures and things like that. And Fleabag, I think, sort of puts itself in that genre early on, although with, I think, a much more interesting style, and then goes down a darker path. And it's ultimately about clinical depression and things like that. And y'all know, I love that shit. So
yeah.
It's great. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, though, she is so terrific on the show. She is an amazing, amazing performer and an amazing writer, too, because the show is beautifully written. And as I said, the 4 episodes I've seen so far are hilarious, but they also go... deeper and darker than I think shows in the kind of milieu it's playing with usually go. And it's fascinating and heartbreaking at times. And just also beautifully made. It's one of this new kind of era of shows we're getting that are shot in full, like, anamorphic widescreen. And the photography is beautiful. Like, we're going to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming later. Many things I love about that movie, one of them is not the visual style.
Right.
I think it's a very kind of dull movie visually. And it's like... and I think that about a lot of Hollywood movies now. And it's like, this show on Amazon, you know, made for the BBC, has better widescreen photography than a lot of movies I see. So I think that's a fascinating thing about it. And again, yeah, the main character, played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who has no name, and so, like, in reviews people call the character Fleabag, because that's the name of the show, and it's a person with a lot of self-loathing, I would say. So
okay.
That kind of makes sense, is where it's coming from. I mean, the show does kind of have this quality, like Louis, almost, where it feels like a filmed version of stand-up. Or of a single person kind of show kind of thing, like a one-woman show. So I love that quality about it. But anyway, getting back to her, you know, a big thing the show does is that she's constantly breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience. And she kind of, like, we are like this person who's always next to her that she's kind of glancing at, spiking the camera, those sorts of things. It's like House of Cards, but interesting and with a purpose.
Okay. Does she put on a Southern American accent?
No, she doesn't. Okay. She has a very British
So it's
accent.
Not like House of Cards is what you're telling me.
No, it's good. But anyway... anyway, if Phoebe Waller-Bridge winds up being the 13th Doctor, like our first female Doctor, mm-hmm. we would be lucky to have her. She is an amazing, amazing actress, first and foremost, and that's I think, the number one thing you need. She also, the thing I see that, like, if she's even in consideration, the reason I see her being in consideration is because she has an incredible range of visual expressiveness, not just to, like, her facial movements and features and everything, but her whole body language. She throws herself into it so fully. And I think if there's one trait an actor needs to pull off that part, that is probably it.
Yeah.
Like, there are plenty of great actors who are... who get their points across in different ways and would not be a good doctor. This is a case where, like, I can see that because I can see her, you know, being able to manipulate her face and body in the ways that the doctor kind of demands.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. She's a little on the young side, but so was Matt Smith, and that worked out. So, yeah. You know, that can always work out. It's hard to see in some senses because Fleabag is an incredibly raunchy R-rated show. And, you know, she would be the first doctor who I've seen in another medium have anal sex, or her character, at least on screen. So, you know.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. But, you know, I've seen Chris Eccleston's penis since he wasn't, not before he was the doctor, but since. So I'm used to the doctor being in raunchy situations.
There you go.
But there we go. Yeah. No, it's a really good show. I can't recommend it highly enough. I was going to try to finish all six for this podcast just because I did want to talk about it. It aired last July, and I think they are prepping a second season at some point. But man, is it good. Amazon has some good shows. I wish I had more time for them, actually. This is the first, I think, of the Amazon originals I've committed to watching. But yeah, I mean, there's too much TV.
There's a lot of TV, yeah.
This one skipped up my queue because it's like, this person might be the next Doctor Who. So, might as well see.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I have been getting off of TV, going to video games. I have been continuing my dive into Nier Automata, which has proved to be very fruitful because that game is really fucking good. And I feel like I'm probably a little past halfway through the game at this point. And so, like, I think I'm seeing where it's going to go fucking crazy from here, because it feels like a game that's, like, it already is kind of, it's offbeat and kind of weird. I think it's going to go totally insane, and I'm really excited for that. But, so I'm at the part where, because this is something about the game that is kind of hard to talk about, is... It is a game that is sort of has this structure that's almost visual novel-esque in terms of you are meant to play through the game multiple times, and not in a, like, oh, it's like New Game Plus kind of way, but in, like, effectively there are multiple different routes through the game, and you have to complete all the different routes to see the full scope of the story and understand what's really going on. So I've completed Route A, and, like, all the endings are named after... Or like, labeled after the alphabet, so there are 26 total, and from what I understand, there's, like, 4 or 5 are, like, the real ones, and there's a bunch of, like, weird little goofy endings that, like, if you do this, like, complete this condition, and then, like, your character dies, it'll give you this little, like, statement about, like, and then this and this and this happened, and then the, like, credits will zoom by in, like, 2 seconds, is like, and then you're dumped at the main menu, and you reload your save, so it's got a bunch of smaller, goofy endings like that. But it's got these sort of, like, again, I don't know the exact number, because I'm trying to avoid spoilers, but the sense I get is there's, like, 4 to 5, like, different kind of routes through the game that give you different perspectives on what's happening. I imagine, like, that's where I've imagined the last route is going to be fucking crazy based on, like, how things have changed already going through starting on Route B. And it's like, and it's not you are, like, going and you're just, like, playing the same thing and you're, like, playing through the game again with, like, some cutscenes are different or something. It's basically a totally new experience that is playing with the knowledge you gained by playing through, like, that timeline one way through, and then it basically has changed almost everything for that is important for you as the player to consume. So, like, when people talk about that you have to play through the game multiple times, don't be, like, scared by that and being like, oh, well, that's bullshit. I've already played through the game. I don't want to have to wade through this again. It's like, you know, it is designed that is effectively like if you were watching a movie or something, it flashes back and shows you, like, a bunch of, like, the scenes from the beginning of the movie from all these different perspectives. It's like, that's how the movie is designed. It is not showing you the exact same footage over and over again. So that's kind of how the game is constructed. And you can tell that Square Enix was a little bit nervous about that side of the game, because when you beat Route A the first time and you get, like, the full credits and everything, at the end of the credits, there's this hilarious little message that pops up that's like, thanks for playing Nier Automata, but you haven't seen the full scope of the game. Maybe consider starting a new game over and see the full scope of what Nier Automata has to offer. Signed, the Square Enix PR team. It literally says Square Enix PR team at the bottom. And it's really hilarious.
So the developers did not write that.
No, yeah. They did not. I think, like, if you have read any interviews or seen anything about the main sort of, like, director of the game, Yoko Taro, he is a very eccentric person that seems like he's not interested in telling people about all the weird corners of the game. But so, yeah, so I'm, like, through Route B, and, like, I'm already, like, kind of, like, speeding through the story because all of your side quest stuff carries over, which feels really good. Like, all your weapons and experience and stuff carries over. So I did a huge amount of the side quest stuff in my first playthrough, so I don't have to, like, worry about that as much. So I'm just kind of racing through it. And the game's just really fun. I think it's got a good, just, like, sense of itself. It's got a really interesting story with really well-drawn characters that is just, like, digging deeper and deeper into these themes about humanity, because the whole game is set way, 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 way in the future where human civilization has been destroyed. They give you this really weird backstory that I imagine is probably... I have not found out what the truth is yet, and I have not even really hinted at it, but I'm just guessing it's probably mostly you are being just lied to, that humanity has fled Earth and is living on the moon and has created all these androids to take Earth back from these aliens that attacked like 10,000 years ago, and the aliens attacked by turning like all the machinery on Earth into these like death machines that are all these like robots just walking around that are trying to kill everybody. And so you are playing as 2B, who's one of the androids who is sent with her partner 9S like down to Earth to just kind of investigate stuff and sort of figure out what's going on with the machines and try to take back Earth bit by bit. And so the themes of the game are a lot about like what is like what separates humanity from the androids, from the robots, like what is consciousness. It's those kinds of science fiction themes. And at first, it's that kind of surface level of it, that if you've seen like Blade Runner or something, you are well versed in how those themes are explored. The deeper you go in, like it complicates those things really heavily in ways that's really interesting. And then aside from just the story stuff, I think the combat, I wish the combat was a little bit more in depth, just based on like how much you have to engage with it at some point, because you know it's a fairly long game. I'm like 18 to 19 hours into it, so at some point you're playing a lot of the combat, and I wish there was a bit more depth, but it is very fun. It's engaging. The animation in the game is unbelievably fucking good. There's a huge amount of variety in the animation, in that like, and like specificity in it, of like every single weapon attack you make, I will just spend like 5 to 10 minutes just like whenever I get a new weapon or like upgraded weapon and sort of increases attack chain, just running around and looking at all the attack animations without having to be in the middle of combat, because like each animation has like a little extra animation at the end that is specified for that attack animation that is like resetting you to your default pose. And so, and that's something you just never see in video games. Usually there's like a very generic, like kind of snap back into your like default combat pose. And this is like, no matter how minor the attack is, whether it's just like two little attacks, like slices with a katana, there's a special little flourish that like returns the character to their default pose and stuff like that. Makes it every time I get into the game, and it's just like, I just kind of want to just like look at it, appreciate the animations, like, and jump around and just swing weapons to just like really observe how smooth and specific and unique all the animation is in the game, because I think that's something that's phenomenal. And then the music is also fantastic. The music has a similar quality to being very, like being varied and like really specific and really designed in for, to get the maximum impact of every single moment in the way that animation is. So like they do little tiny touches, like having unique variations on themes in the game that transition more smoothly from like, if you're going from the ruined city into the desert and then like the kind of transitionary zone, it's not just like the ruined city music fades out and the desert music fades up. It's like the music slowly changes so that the themes fade from that one composition into the next composition. And that is present all throughout the game, of like the way it fades into battle themes and out of battle themes, the way it'll fade into a vocalized version of the song and then out of the vocalized version of the song based on like how deep into a zone you are in and stuff like that. There are a huge number of different variations of all the different compositions in the game, and the way it makes use of that is so beautiful and is something that like only a video game could do. And so it's not just like the music is fantastic, it's the implementation of the music is like on a next level that most video games don't get at. And that's something that I think is kind of true about a lot of the stuff in the game, that how they use the story, how they use the music, how they use all those little things, or they're thinking about how can we take this and make these things feel specific to the experience of the player playing this game. And that thoughtfulness is really, really cool.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm very excited to get in and finish. I'm almost definitely going to be done with the game by next week, so I'm excited to finish it up.
Awesome. I have not been playing much in terms of video games lately. I think I've needed a break.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
The first half of the year was really heavy.
Like, it was. I have Horizon Zero Dawn sitting on my PS4. I will get to it. That's the one thing from the first half of the year I'm, like, committed to playing that I didn't get to. I obviously played a lot from the first half of the year. But, like, once we get into August, things are going to get crazy again. So I've actually been watching a lot of movies for a project you guys will hear about soon. But, like, I've been having fun with that. The today was the first day of the Criterion Collection sale at Barnes & Noble for July. And spent some money on that. I had to do it online and not go to a store because I'm the kind of Criterion fan who the stuff I like is so obscure, it doesn't even get to the stores. So, anyway, been having fun with that. Been diving into
Is there anything really good on sale right now that, you want to shout out?
Oh boy, I mean the whole, they put the whole collection on sale. So any, you know, this is, if you ever have wanted to get into the Criterion Collection and you know how much I love them, I pretty much only buy on sale days, and that's Barnes & Noble. It's the whole month of July and the whole month of November. So that's, you have those windows. So you can kind of save up for those 2 months. And then I think there's 3 or 4 days through the year where the Criterion website does a 24-hour flash sale. So that's always when I buy stuff. And again, they always put the whole collection on sale. I have not, this has not been a year where they've released a lot that I'm personally interested in. And that's not me saying they've had a bad year. It's just they release a lot of kinds of films. And they haven't had a lot that's in sort of my neck of the woods. But they've had some cool stuff. I mean, if I were to pick up a new release at the moment, boy, they just put out the Peter Sellers film Being There, and I might have to get that, because they also just put out a different label, Shout Factory, did the whole Pink Panther collection on Blu-ray, and I'm working through that as well, and I love those movies, and I'm reminded, like, oh, Peter Sellers, you were gone too soon. And anyway, but I've been actually working through different, again, when I talk about being obscure, Criterion has this sub-label called the Eclipse Series, which are like DVD-only box sets where they don't have a lot of bonus features and they're not able to remaster the film super well, but they do put them out, and they're often more obscure films, like lesser-known films by major directors. There's, like, you know, for instance, 2 Kurosawa box sets, to name a director a lot of people would know from that collection. And I was getting some of those, just diving into more corners of old Japanese cinema, which is, that's kind of my zone of scholarship, I guess I would say, is either some modern Japanese film and then a lot of, like, golden era 30s, 40s, 50s. And I've been getting into buying some box sets of more of that. And that's one of the things I love about the Criterion Collection is they, again, those are not, like, the nicest, best sets in the world they put out, but they get them out there. And I love having those on physical media. So I've been having fun with that. What I was going to say, though, is talking about movies in theaters I've seen. And I have two I want to talk about, one of which doesn't come out until this Friday. And that's War for the Planet of the Apes. This is, we're recording this on Tuesday. I got to see this last night. Monday, they had, like, the nationwide premiere in New York, and they streamed that to Alamo Drafthouse locations throughout the country, and I got an invite to one of those, and they did, like, a live Q&A before the show, live streamed from New York with Andy Serkis and the director Matt Reeves and Woody Harrelson, who is awesome, and Steve Zahn, who is awesome, and other people involved in the movie, and so that was fun, and after the Q&A, we got to see the movie, and you guys, I think I've talked about before, I really like this new Planet of the Apes trilogy, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which was the first one. Very good, flawed in some ways, but really interesting, and Andy Serkis, a revelation, even knowing how great an actor he is, and then Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, where Matt Reeves came on board, the next director, he, I think, really made that series better, and that's an even better film. And War for the Planet of the Apes is better still. So this trilogy is officially the Bourne trilogy of the 2010s, because it's three movies, each one is better than the last, a different director did the last two, and feels like the definitive director for the series, and ultimately I think they do something for Hollywood blockbusters that nobody else is even approaching on this level. I think just the level of how good the storytelling is, how direct the storytelling is, how much they are able to imbue thematically into these films, how much characterization there is to the main ape cast. You know, this is a series that started with something resembling a main human character in the James Franco figure in the first movie, but by the end of that movie, it was Andy Serkis' show, and only the ape actors are the people in all three movies. The human cast changes every time. But War for the Planet of the Apes is outstanding, and I highly recommend it. I won't say anything spoilery here, obviously, other than you absolutely should go see it. But let me say a couple things about it. You know, like I said, I do think it's the best one of these so far. It very much functions, like the Bourne Ultimatum, another good example, as an ending, in that you could do more, but knowing what happened to that trilogy, the Bourne movies, you probably shouldn't, and leave well enough alone, because this movie comes to an absolutely beautiful stopping point. Again, they can always do more, because, hey, there were more Planet of the Apes movies before, obviously. They can always do more apes movies.
They could do before the Planet of the Apes if they wanted.
Sure. Is that, God, is that a title of one of them already?
I think it is.
I thought it was Beneath. Is there a Beneath.
I think there's a Before. I'm going to look it up while you're talking.
No worries.
There are a lot of old Planet of the Apes movies, and they have some weird titles.
Anyway, War for the Planet of the Apes is a grand capper to the trilogy. One thing I will say is it's not the movie they're marketing.
Okay, and, yeah, because I saw a trailer for it in front of Spider-Man, and it seemed okay, but I didn't get a good sense of what the movie was.
Well, the movie they're marketing, and it comes down to the title, which I also think is a massive misnomer, because it's promising like this big war, this giant eruption of conflict between the humans and the apes, and that's really not the movie. There's a little bit of that, but I would even say this movie has less of what I would call action sequences than either of the first two. It is a less action-driven movie. It has a little bit at the beginning and a little bit at the end, but in neither way case are those really like Caesar, our main character, the Andy Serkis character. It's not him like driving the action. It's like him existing within a larger action framework. Mm-hmm. So this movie is actually, it's calmer, it's slower, it's more contemplative than the other movies. And Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the second one, is a very slow movie. It's one of the things I love about it. This is slower still, it's more contemplative, it's so much about where the characters are, what they're going through, what decisions they are making when pushed against a wall. And I think it's fascinating and very well done. I do think some people are going to bounce right off this movie because they're advertising it as, like, you know, big ape war conflict. And the trailer even has some very misleading cuts of, like, what is going on. And that does not bother me because the movie that they made is so good, and that's marketing. But I do understand, like, if you're thinking, this is the one where we finally get an all-out ape war kind of thing, that's not the movie. And just know that going in, it's something different, it's something beautiful and wonderful, but it's not exactly that. What this movie does do that I love is that it puts us squarely from the point of view of the apes. We never break POV from Caesar and company to go, like, to a human camp or something. And the first two movies have that. They go back and forth a little bit, and necessarily so, to tell the stories they're telling. This one is all apes all the time, and it is better for it.
Well, technically, all the movies are all apes all the time, because humans are apes, but...
Yes.
It's one of the confusing things about the Planet of the Apes series, is that it's like, well, we are the apes. We've always been apes.
Well, what is the difference between humans and apes, Sean?
There's not much of one, really. Yeah.
Well, anyway, this movie does have some human characters. The only, like, big name of note you're going to see is Woody Harrelson, and he's phenomenal in this. Woody Harrelson is never not good in things, but he is so fully engaged in this movie, and he is scary, and he is messed up, and he is wonderful in this film. And then there's also a character, an actress who you would not have seen before because she's a little kid, who is one of the other sort of main characters in this from the human side. But other than that, not a lot on the humans, but you do learn about kind of what human society is going through. But again, they keep the POV so strict, and I find it so interesting. It really is about Caesar and his camp and his apes and where they are trying to get to in life and in the world. And the human stuff is necessarily on the periphery because that doesn't really, that's not their society.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting how it handles all of that. The performances, well, I mentioned Woody Harrelson, but from all the ape actors, God, it's good. I don't know what more you can say about Andy Serkis at this point. I think he will be remembered from this generation as Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton are from the early 1900s.
Sure,
he is that kind of actor. I think he is that kind of innovator. I think he has basically invented a new style of acting in this kind of stuff, and this is the biggest expression of that yet, this trilogy, where I think you really get this sense of motion capture is like expensive makeup for him. It just allows him to play a character that he does not look like, but it is 100% his performance underneath, and he has played this character from infancy in Rise of the Planet of the Apes to now full maturity in War for the Planet of the Apes, and that's just an arc. You know, a lot of actors are never going to be able to play because of technology and, frankly, talent. And he is wonderful. And the thing I see over and over again in interviews and stuff is other people are so in awe of Andy Serkis. And this came up with that Q&A, too, where everyone is fawning over him. And it's genuine. They really think this. I think you get in a room with him, even if he's in a crazy mocap costume, and it's like, this is an actor who challenges me to be better. I mean, even Woody Harrelson was saying that. And Woody Harrelson's a legend, you know? Yeah. That's great. But Andy Serkis is great. Steve Zahn joins the cast as a new ape, and he is wonderful. He is ostensibly kind of a comic relief because this is an incredibly dark movie. Like, this is one of the darkest Hollywood movies for the summer season I think I've ever seen. And he gives us a little bit of humor, but he's also a very tragic character. And then I think the actor, honestly, I would note is Karen Connival, who is not like a name actor or anything, but she has played this ape Maurice, who is like, she's a big orangutan. And that's Caesar's, like, number two since the first movie. And Maurice steals the show in this movie. It's amazing character and amazing work, especially considering an orangutan's face is the least like a humans of all the apes.
Orangutans are more removed from humans than like a chimpanzee or a gorilla would be.
So I think it speaks to the quality of the animation, but also that performance is extraordinary. And yeah, it's a moving film. It is beautifully shot by Michael Saracen, who is one of my favorite cinematographers, and did great work on Dawn, great work here. It looks beautiful. It looks like no other Hollywood movie right now. The special effects, I mean, they're the best in film history. There's no other way to say it. This movie would not exist if they weren't the best in film history.
Right.
Because you have to have CGI characters who look 100% realistic. Because this is not like Avatar, where you have mocap, but then also the environments are animated. So really, Avatar is just an animated movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is live action. It's all... they're out there in the environment shooting this stuff, and then and actually the ape actors are out there too in the mocap costumes, in the snow and in the woods and stuff doing this, and then they put the CGI on top of that, again, like a new form of makeup or something.
Yeah.
But the special effects, Weta Digital, just I think they are the most important effects house in this era of film, and what they do has blown the lid off, I think, what's possible in movies right now. And then I also wanted to give a shout-out to Michael Giacchino, who did the score for this, and I think... love Michael Giacchino. I've found his music pretty boring in the last few years. He's done a lot of work, but I haven't found a lot of it notable.
Yeah.
I think this is the best score he's done since 2009, the Star Trek, which is the last one I would say really caught my attention and imagination. It is gorgeous here, and I also think Matt Reeves directs to his talents in interesting ways, where you get some of those moments like on Lost, or in the first Star Trek, or in some of the Pixar movies, where the other sound kind of goes out and allows him to do his thing. And it's gorgeous. So yeah, it's a really fantastic movie. I absolutely urge you to see it. And if you have not caught up in this trilogy, you're missing maybe the most exciting series Hollywood has had in recent years, just in terms of what a absolute fucking surprise it is, because this should not have worked.
Cool.
And it worked beautifully.
Yeah, I think I'm going to jump in on it now.
Yeah, I have the Blu-ray. I bought the Blu-rays to show to my brother, so if you want to borrow them, I can give those to you.
I will make use of that. Before we move on, I want to just read all the titles for all the Planet of the Apes movies, because there's so fucking many now. And Before the Planet of the Apes is not one of them. There's one that sounds a lot like Before the Planet of the Apes. So there's Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes, which I think I may have heard that title and thought it said Before the Planet of the Apes. Because I think I'm surprised that there isn't a Before the Planet of the Apes as a prequel.
Frankly, if I were to give these movies titles,
yeah,
because I think the trilogy that they've just made, all of them have bad titles.
Yes.
I would call the first one Before the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
The one with James Franco. That's Before the Planet of the Apes. I would call the second one Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And just leave that in the middle. And then the third one, I'm not sure what I would call it.
Planet of the Apes 2.
I don't think I would call it War for the Planet of the Apes, because that's not what it is. I don't know. I would almost call it Time of the Planet of the Apes or something. I don't know. Something cheesy like that.
Yeah.
But there are other ways you could say that. But anyway, they also do something, I'm not going to spoil it, in the very beginning of the movie that cheekily references the weird titles of this series. And it made me cackle a little bit.
Yeah.
So. It's good. The other movie I saw, I got to this late, even though this is a director I love and I was so excited for this movie, but I was busy with other things and for a while I didn't have a car and no one wanted to see the movie with me. So anyway, that's Baby Driver.
Right, the new
Edgar Wright film.
I've heard a lot about this.
So Edgar Wright is a director I love. He did the Cornetto trilogy with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Love all three of those movies. I love Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So I was excited for Baby Driver, his fifth movie. And he had been delayed for a while because he had that thing with Ant-Man a few years ago and was robbed of making a movie. So we were waiting for him to make a new one. Baby Driver is a... Someone asked me, like, what's that about? And I was like, it was really hard to explain. And I said, it's kind of like a car chase movie, but also a musical. And that is what it is. It is...
I have not seen the movie, I think I can kind of understand what you're getting at just by that.
So the whole premise of Baby Driver is the main character, whose like code name is Baby, is a getaway driver for this organization of thieves. They go rob banks and he drives the getaway car. Baby has some trauma in his past and he has this hearing issue where he has tinnitus, the ringing in your ears.
Right.
So he is constantly listening to music. He has all these different iPods he uses. I read a fun article on Macworld the other day that apparently this is like bringing up interest in old iPods, because this movie heavily features... like Baby Driver is the moment where iPods have become nostalgia. Because they are nostalgically used in this movie.
And then we had the Zune joke at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. So it's, I guess we are in that period of early MP3 players being a thing of nostalgia for people kind of our age or a little older.
So Baby is constantly listening to music and he has his headphones in all the time. And he times like all his car chases to the rhythm of the songs he's listening to. And so the entire movie is choreographed, edited, shot to the music Baby is listening to. And that's not to say the entire movie is a car chase. This isn't Mad Max Fury Road. That'd be crazy. But who would have ever tried to make a whole movie a car chase?
Yeah.
That would take some balls. No. But there is pretty much something coming out of his iPod for all 2 hours of the movie. And I actually think the sound mix of this movie is extraordinary, because they really play with, like, if he's got the headphones in, but, like, just one bud is in and the other is hanging out, the music is low in the mix in a way where it sounds like you're in the room with music coming out of headphones.
Huh.
And if it's in his ears, it's through the stereo and everything, but it is a little muffled like normal iPod headphones would be. And if it's out of the radio of a car, it sounds big and, like, beefy like out of the radio of a car would be. So, like, the sound design is great. But there's always some music playing. The soundtrack to this movie, I got it. It's a full 2 hours long and 30 songs. So it's a long mixtape of songs. And from all eras and all types of styles and stuff. And Edgar Wright's soundtracks are always wonderful. And this is probably the best one he's compiled for a movie yet. And it has to be, because that's the movie. And the movie is so well edited and shot where I watch some of these sequences, and I don't know how you make this movie in some sense, because you have to know every song, and you have to have all of this choreographed before you start shooting a second of it, because it's down to little motions of a character's arm and stuff. It is syncing to the music, and it's fascinating how they do all of this, and it works. It makes the car chases really, really exciting and interesting, but even just on down to characters walking down the street and stuff like that, it's really fascinating how Edgar Wright uses all of that, and I think it's more proof that he is a very interesting, stylish director. This is by far the most, like, style over substance movie I think he's made. It's really a heavy exercise in style. But when the style is this good, you don't really care. And part of that style is the cast in this movie is so fucking great. You've got Jamie Foxx playing a bad guy, and it is maybe the most I've ever enjoyed Jamie Foxx in a movie. And that's not a slight, because I love Jamie Foxx, but he is fucking cool and awesome in this. And terrifying, because he's an armed robber and those sorts of things.
Right.
You've got Kevin Spacey as, like, Baby's evil mentor who, like, runs the whole... He's, like, a white-collar businessman who runs this, you know, weird criminal ring on the side or something. And Kevin Spacey is always fun, and I enjoyed seeing him here. And then you've got Jon Hamm from Mad Men, giving an amazing performance. This is the biggest performance, like, in terms of size in the movie I've seen him give since Mad Men went off the air. And the critic Matt Zollersite said this on Twitter, and it's so true. He plays his role in this as though it's Don Draper if he made just a couple different decisions in life. And I love that. It is Jon Hamm, very charming, very funny, but he's also a guy who kills people and robs and all this stuff, and he is wonderful. And the progression that character goes over through the course of the movie is amazing. And there's a scene he has late in the film that is both terrifying and hilarious. And it's a side of Jon Hamm I've never seen. And I loved it. And I love Jon Hamm. Mad Men is one of my favorite shows. So wonderful to see him. Baby's girlfriend, who a lot of the film revolves around, is played by this actress, Lily James, who I haven't seen in a ton of stuff before. I know she was in Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella. And I guess she was on Downton Abbey for a time because she's British, and if you were on Downton Abbey, I think, or something like that. And she's very, very good. Just so charismatic and charming and everything the movie needs her to be. Even though it's a very restrictive role, this movie trades in very 1950s archetypes.
Hmm.
And I think knowingly so. It's not like it's unaware that that's what it's doing. It's a throwback in a lot of ways. But that also means, like, this is very much like she's the greaser's girlfriend kind of thing. And I do think Edgar Wright could have written a slightly more active part for her in parts of the movie. But mostly I walked out of it thinking, I can't wait to see Lily James in something like this, but where she's the lead, because she's fantastic. The one thing that holds me back from thinking Baby Driver is maybe a great movie, like I would say Edgar Wright's others are, is the main character, Baby. I love the conception of the character. I love the way he's used. I think the actor, Ansel Elgort, is miscast. I don't think he's bad. He's fine. But that is a role, like, think of all the actors I just listed. That is a charisma machine this movie is putting out. You need a character in the center there who is a young Marlon Brando or James Dean or someone from that era of film that the movie is calling from. And he is not that. He looks like he's 12, for one. Like, he looks like he should be in Spider-Man Homecoming as, like, Spider-Man's little brother. He looks way too young for this movie. And he's supposed to be, like, an innocent little kid kind of thing. But I think they take it... I think he's too young looking for even what they're asking.
Do you think maybe in the other direction would they have been better served by casting a literal baby as Baby? And just, like, instead of, like, no, he's not young enough.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I really do think, like, it's someone who needs to be able to kind of ooze a certain amount of charisma, in part because the romance in the film kind of relies on it, in the same way that, like, you know, a Rebel Without a Cause is something I thought of a little bit, that, you know, they don't do a ton of scenes with the romance between Natalie Wood and James Dean in that movie, but James Dean is a sex god, and you get it.
Yeah.
And Natalie Wood is awesome, and you get it. Lily James holds up that side of it in Baby Driver, but I don't think Ansel Elgort is able to quite get there. He's better in the second half of the movie when it asks him to be a more fully engaged character, but I think just in this sort of standard, like, sitting back and just kind of, you know, watching the world around him, you need someone who is magnetic there, and I don't think he's that, and I don't think it cripples the movie, but it is something that you watch a lot of scenes and you're like, if that part worked better, this would be an A+ in parts, and it's like an A- or something in how well it's working on you. So I absolutely recommend the film. It is a ton of fun. Of every movie I've seen this summer, this is probably the one I would rewatch most happily. If you sat me down and said, you need to watch one of these again, I'd be like, I want to watch Baby Driver again, because that was a ton of fun, and I love the music and stuff like that. But yeah, I think the main actor doesn't quite work. Okay. So, yeah. He was one of the people in the running to play Han Solo, and I'm probably glad they didn't do that, because even young Han Solo shouldn't look that young, because I just don't think Harrison Ford ever looked that young. He came out of the womb with the scar and everything, right?
Yeah, he was born looking like he was around 30.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Baby Driver, thumbs up. Been a lot of good movies at the box office this summer at the theaters. Well, yeah, I really broke down on that sentence. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, all these great movies like Transformers 5 and...
Okay, skip those. But, yeah, I mean, no. We've had a pretty good summer, I think, with everything we've had to watch. Guardians 2 and Wonder Woman and...
Pirates of the Caribbean.
You're listing five? The exceptions. Yeah, 5.
Fuck. How are there the same number of Transformers movies as there are Pirates of the Caribbean movies? How is this the world we live in?
But those two movies bombed horribly.
Exactly.
All the movies we like did really well, surprisingly. Yeah. So, you know, you got Spider-Man Homecoming. Do you want to go ahead and talk about it?
Sure, yeah.
Let's talk about Spider-Man Homecoming.
Spider-Man.
All right, we'll have spoilers from here on out, although the trailers spoiled it plenty for you.
Yeah, it's like, it's not a movie you can spoil. I mean, there's one moment at the beginning of the third act that, like, would be bad to have spoiled because it's a really good moment. But other than that, it is not a spoiler kind of movie.
But you should absolutely see it if you haven't yet. Yeah. And if you have any affection for Spider-Man, this movie will feel like it's giving you a big warm hug.
Yes.
So Spider-Man Homecoming. Sean, I re-listened to our Amazing Spider-Man 2 podcast last week. Because I was just...
I wouldn't even want to re-listen to it. Because I just want to go... I don't want to go back into that headspace.
No, I get it.
I want to be as far away from that as possible.
But I wanted to, like, set up the contrast. Last time we talked about a Spider-Man movie, we were hopeless. We thought this was, like, the end of superhero movies. Because that movie is so bad.
It's so fucking terrible.
It's just a terrible movie, but it also misreads its characters so enormously.
Yeah.
This is, like, the qualitative inverse of that in so many ways. We were excited for this for a number of reasons, in part because we got to see Tom Holland play the character in Civil War, which was only a year ago, which blows me away when I think about it. But we were very excited for it. It's out. Do you think it lived up to it? What do you think of Homecoming?
I think it absolutely lived up to it. I think, like, if you are a Spider-Man fan, like, this is such a delightful movie to watch because it definitely, it so understands the core of that character and, like, what makes that character work. But brings him forward into 2017 in a way that, like, it reminded me a lot of what it felt like reading Ultimate Spider-Man in the early 2000s when Ultimate Spider-Man was new, and that was the updated version of Spider-Man by Brian Michael Bendis. And for that, like, for the millennials, because here's something to get out of the way immediately. I've heard some people calling this the millennial Spider-Man movie. No, the millennial is like from around 1980 to like around 1994, 1995-ish. We had Millennial Spider-Man. That was Tobey Maguire. Tobey Maguire was the Millennial Spider-Man movie. That was the Spider-Man movie that was made for millennials when they were in the core demographic. Like us.
Yes.
This is like the fucking whatever the next generation is going to be.
Because this is a Spider-Man who was born after the year 2000.
Yes, he's like 7 years younger than we are.
Yes.
Like, it's...
I mean, and that's a really big thing to say. This was kind of an out-of-body experience for me, watching a Spider-Man who is noticeably younger than I am and made me feel old and sad.
Yeah, so that's the kind of the differences. Like, we had Ultimate Spider-Man in the early 2000s, which was like contemporary with the Tobey Maguire movies. In fact, there's like there's a really good story arc in like volume 5 or something of Ultimate Spider-Man where it kind of does almost like a half crossover in a crazy way with the Tobey Maguire movies. But this this is the fully new Spider-Man. It feels like almost to the point where I do kind of wish that they had just gone full bore with it and made him Miles Morales, even if, on the other hand, a lot of Miles Morales' story arcs rely on the fact that he is trying to live up to a pre-existing Spider-Man legacy. That makes that kind of hard. But there is, like, I kind of almost wish they made an even cleaner break because of how modern and hip and fresh and, you know, for, like, the Tumblr, Snapchat, whatever, the audience that exists today, you know, the audience of kids that if you say MySpace, they like look at you like, what the fuck did you just say? What the fuck are you talking about, old man? And so like it's got that like new feeling to it that is, like you said, it's almost kind of like mind bending of being like, right, oh Jesus Christ, I'm like not just older than Spider-Man, I'm like I'm much older than Spider-Man. I'm like a generation apart from Spider-Man.
And it's not just Spider-Man. It's the whole cast. It's a very, for one, it's a cast that looks like you would find in New York. It is multiracial.
Yeah.
It is a diverse cast. Spider-Man's best friend is Asian. His crush is black, you know, those sorts of things. And you have this group of kids, you know, who hang out after school together and do their
They're like academic decathlon.
Academic decathlon. Yeah. And it all feels very organic and very real and not like someone thinking like, what do kids do in high school?
Yeah.
It feels like they actually went to a high school and saw what kids do.
Yeah, and it's got that, it has all that high school Spider-Man stuff and it hits all the right beats of like, you know, he's got, and it like hits all the right beats and then adds, I think, a couple of new ones in there to make it feel a bit different. But it has the, all the implicit sort of great power, great responsibility stuff, even if they don't ever say it in the movie and they don't ever directly address Uncle Ben. Like, the, definitely that shadow hangs over. You get the sense of, like, Peter's very dedicated to this. He's passionate about being Spider-Man. He feels incredibly driven to be Spider-Man. But being Spider-Man is very costly for him personally. And it means he's not going to be able to make it to the academic decathlon. It means he's, like, not... He's, you know, Aunt May is going to have to worry about him constantly. It means he has to lie to everyone in his personal life. It means, like, his homecoming dance is going to get all fucked up. It means, like, everything that's going on in Peter Parker's life takes a huge... pays a huge price because of everything he has to do in being Spider-Man. So it keeps all of that stuff. And then it also puts, I think, a more fresh sort of element into it that's not, I think, inherent to the Spider-Man character. That's sort of the core theme or thematic, like, core of the movie is a lot about his, like, relationship with Tony and his need to, like, kind of prove himself. And it is kind of like what we talked about when we saw the first trailers is that this movie is about sort of, like, this version of Spider-Man's first real, like, go at it. It's his big adventure. It's his, like, first time finding his own supervillain on his own, basically, and having to sort of, like, get used to that idea and, like, be a proper superhero and not just be the guy who, like, kind of helps out every once in a while. This is his, like, real first test as Spider-Man. And I think there's something that's really appealing about that to me, and I think they do a good job of telling that story because it's not quite the exact same story I've seen every other time I've seen a Spider-Man movie or read a Spider-Man comic.
It's funny because so often when we talk about origin stories, it's all about, like, what's the thing that made the character be a superhero?
Yeah.
And it's less, once they're the superhero, how do they grapple with that? And a lot of even the best origin stories movies, of which I would count 2002 Spider-Man, which is an incredible movie, and don't make fun of it, it's really fucking good, guys.
Yes, it is.
And
it's awesome.
But that movie does not grapple with that in the same way. It is about the origin, but once he becomes Spider-Man, he's good at the web-slinging.
Yeah.
He's good in a fight. It's like he got all of that innately, and we don't see kind of the build of that. Spider-Man Homecoming does not recount Spider-Man's origin story in that he gets bitten by a spider, and then he goes to the wrestling thing, and then he doesn't stop the robber, and then Uncle... It doesn't do any of that. And it fairly aggressively doesn't do any of that. Like, to the point where I thought we might even get, like, an Uncle Ben cameo. They don't even say his name, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're... And given how they're all joking about how young Marissa Tomei looks, they really could have had Channing Tatum as Uncle Ben, and it would have been hilarious.
Yeah.
But that's not what they did. No, they pretty aggressively ignore the literal origin story. But this is a kind of superhero origin story I don't think we see much, which is once you've got the powers and you're dedicated to being a hero and doing the right thing... What is the challenge in that? This is not a Spider-Man who is comfortable in everything he does. There's a lot of, like, he is not going around webbing around the city feeling super confident and doing the flips and everything. It's oftentimes like, shit, how do I do this? how do I get around this? Like, if I'm gonna, okay, there's four guys in this bank, and I have to fight this. This is actually much harder than I thought. Yeah. And I really liked all of that. And there's, we're gonna talk about how much I think they get the Peter Parker character right, especially the Spider-Man character right. But like, I do think there is something so unique about that that he has to prove himself because he himself is not yet fully developed as a superhero. He had this, and I think this is an example actually of Marvel leveraging their cinematic universe really well to tell a story. Because I think the whole idea of, in Civil War, we met Spider-Man, he got to fight with the Avengers, had this amazing adventure from which he didn't have to suffer any of the negative fallout.
Right, yeah.
You know, so he just thought it was all fun and games. Gets to go back home, and then nothing. And I think it's a really interesting story. And I've seen some complaints that Tony Stark is too much of a dick in this movie. And my thought is, that's Tony Stark.
Have you not seen the other fucking movies he's in? Tony Stark is a massive prick.
Yeah. My reaction was, yeah, that's, I think if you were Peter Parker and that was your relationship with Tony Stark, that's what it would feel like. Because Tony is very caring to the people directly in his orbit. Peter Parker is not directly in his orbit. And I liked seeing Tony Stark as though he is this kind of elder statesman, you know, of this universe, even though when we see him normally, we're from his POV. And that's not the case here. And yes, he does come off as a dick because he's Tony Stark. And that's why you hire Robert Downey Jr., God damn it. Anyway, but I really like that. This thing he's trying to live up to, and he's trying to get to Avenger level. And so he winds up embroiled in this mystery that I think is very well written and seeded through the movie that keeps pushing him and testing him. And yeah, I actually think this movie has an outstanding script. That's the number one thing I would identify it as a piece of filmmaking. Is the script is credited to 6 people, which usually means it's a mess. It's not here. It actually feels like something you'd get from like a TV writer's room, and that it's very well thought through to me. And it feels like each beat leads very well into the next one. It feels like the arc is constantly being considered. I think the movie is, while being a little on the long side, it's like 2 hours, 10 minutes, is pretty lean in terms of, it does not have a lot of fat on its body.
Yeah.
Down to, there were actually moments where I wish they slowed down and had a little more of Aunt May or a little more of this. But overall, it's like they're pretty laser focused on what is Peter thinking in this moment, what leads into the next moment. It's a very, very well written film for all those reasons we're saying. And then also just the character writing throughout is incredible.
Yeah. And I think, like, to go back to what you said about it feeling like almost like the product of a like really strong TV show style writer's room, is I have to say that's almost like across the whole movie, it feels like, and it's something that, like, I'm almost kind of bummed that it isn't this. Like, I just kind of wish that this was, like, a super long, like super pilot for a TV show. Because it's like, if this was like what they did with the Star Wars Clone Wars movie, where they're just like, we'll take, like, the first 3 to 4 episodes and just kind of, like, stitch them together and put it in movie theater, and it has, like, a better budget and stuff, and, you know, we can get all these, more name actors and everything to play, like, the villain and everything. If that was what this was, this feels like such a perfect setup for a, like, brilliant Spider-Man TV show, where they've set up, like, all the principal characters, they, like, create a really strong core supporting cast of characters that take inspiration and some names from historical Spider-Man characters like Liz Allen or, like, Flash Thompson, but are not exactly those characters. They're, like, it's kind of like they pass, like, the squint test, but when you, like, really examine it, it's like, no, these are fresh new supporting characters that have, like, their own character arcs and their own kind of, like, things going on with them. This movie does such a good job of setting up that world and of, like, ending with a sense of, like, I want to see, you know, the next episode where Spider-Man goes and, like, has to deal with, like, another villain that sort of has this, like, cobbled together something from alien machinery and, like, you know, this whole season-long arc about wrapping up that stuff or whatever. It is such a strong setup for that, because I think that's one of the things that it gets so perfectly about the Spider-Man character, is that he is designed at his base to be in a serialized storytelling format. That's, like, I think one of the reasons why he's a teenager. That's one of the reasons why he has a much more notable supporting cast than a lot of superheroes do. It's like he's got this whole sort of thing of where he can change and evolve and progress over the course of his series because he starts so young, that most superhero characters do not. You know, like, Tony Stark is a pretty static character. Captain America is a pretty static character. The DC superheroes are especially very static characters most of the time. And Spider-Man has never been that. It's never been about that at all. And this movie gets that so right that it's almost kind of disappointing. That's like, oh, why can't they just make this a... I get that there's, like, budgetary reasons and stuff that Spider-Man is way harder to do than a hero like Daredevil in that way. But I want the Netflix TV show version of Spider-Man. Like, I want that. I want to be able to, like, jump in on his adventures once a week. And, like, even though I'm super excited to see what the next movie is, it feels like this movie sort of, like, hits on Spider-Man so well that it kind of also hits on why Spider-Man is not necessarily designed to be a movie superhero.
I agree. I think this movie, is more televisual than it is cinematic.
Yeah.
And I think that stylistically and somewhat narratively, you know, we've talked a lot with Twin Peaks The Return about, you know, what I've been calling the convergence of film and TV, and that I think we're going to have to start thinking about these less as two separate walled-off mediums, and to me it's just all filmmaking.
That's like, exists kind of, on like the spectrum of, yes, like kind of what you're aiming for.
Right, and you know, so that's, so when I call something televisual or TV cinematic, I'm not trying to elevate or put anything else down. I'm trying to find the language to talk about this spectrum that we're on. Right. Because I think just treating them as two separate mediums is going to quickly become reductive, especially because I think movie theaters are going to start dying off pretty soon. So that's a different discussion. Anyway, but I think, you know, Marvel has definitely been kind of at the forefront of their movies are in many ways more of a televisual exercise than they are cinematic, because they are this serialized thing. They get at least two out a year. You have these constant connections through them. Some of their movies are absolutely beautiful and belong on the big screen, like your Doctor Stranges and Guardians of the Galaxies and Avengers and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you do have the smaller ones like this, and I think this leans into it the hardest, where visually I think it's a pretty flat movie, not poorly made or anything, just that it's not trying to stake out a super distinctive visual style. I think it works totally fine for what it is. I do think John Watts, the director, struggles a little bit with action scenes in terms of just cutting and cinematography,
yeah,
although I like the imagination of all of them. But then, you know, it does have this feeling where about halfway through the movie, I thought, I feel like I'm kind of binge-watching a couple episodes of Spider-Man. And again, I don't say that necessarily as a criticism. That's, yeah, not me saying, like, they made this in the wrong medium or something like that. Again, if you're doing Spider-Man right, in some ways you're going to feel like that. I think Sam Raimi kind of did the only way you can do Spider-Man super cinematically. And I actually think one of the lessons of the Amazing Spider-Man movies is they basically tried to do Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2.0, and they couldn't do it. I don't, yeah, think that's a repeatable thing. And so they went in a very different, like an aggressively different direction here. And it works, again, because it's not trying to be the big cinematic version like a Spider-Man 2 or something like,
yeah,
that. But yeah, I think it's an interesting, again, as we get this convergence, you know, I think it's undeniable something like Twin Peaks The Return is more quote-unquote cinematic than Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
And it's almost laughable to compare them, but it is instructive. Even though,
but Spider-Man Homecoming has this quality to it of like this warmth with the characters, yes, that is something I associate more with TV shows and, yes, like this larger cast, whereas like Twin Peaks The Return, well, it has like good, strong, memorable characters, does not have that like closeness to them in the way that like a like TV show normally does.
Right. Like, I'm happy to watch Twin Peaks The Return for the 18 episodes we're going to get, but if somehow that became a yearly, like, we're going to get 18 episodes every year, I'd be horrified by,
oh,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the, what they did with old Twin Peaks. Where,
exactly,
like, this does not work like this. This is not, yeah, this does not exist in this
And
format.
I do think it's worth, you know, praising, like, even if we wish we had more of Spider-Man Homecoming, that's a testament to how well it does in these 2 hours.
Yeah.
It is dense with good characters and,
absolutely,
good character moments, and it is amazing after just 2 hours of film, you come out loving this cast.
Yeah.
I mean, Ned is one of my favorite characters in the MCU.
He's so good.
He is an amazing character creation.
Yeah. Like, it's also because it's impressive because on one hand, it's like a very like stereotypical kind of character that he's put to play, but they pull it off so perfectly, it never feels like that.
It feels like, and with most of the kid characters here, it felt like they found a kid at a high school and was like,
yeah,
you want to be in a Spider-Man movie? He feels so completely like someone, kind of like someone I could have known in high school, but younger. Like, you know,
yeah,
not quite of my generation, but I get it. I know that kind of kid. I've even, you know, I work in education and I've taught high school kids. Feels like someone I've taught, maybe,
yeah,
you know, like, it really does feel like a real person. Tom Holland absolutely, I think, has that quality. He's not doing a traditional kind of movie star Spider-Man. He's doing kid Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think down to Zendaya playing the Michelle character, and I forget the name of the actress who plays Liz, I think you have that quality. I love Tony Revolori as Flash Thompson.
Yeah.
That is an amazing take on Flash.
It's a very, very good... I would say it is not necessarily a high hurdle, but it is the best movie Flash Thompson so far.
It's funny. It's like, it's what the Amazing Spider-Man movies did not understand about modern bullying, which is that those kids aren't cool anymore.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's a complete fucking dweeb who no one likes, and that's why he works in this,
yeah,
setting.
I also, like, one thing I love about how they have updated Spider-Man is they have changed, like, the nickname they call Peter from Puny Parker, which is what the, like, 60s comics did, to Petus Parker.
Yes.
It's very good.
It does feel like something modern kids,
yeah,
would say.
It's much more appropriate when they have, when it does that cut to back to the party and he has all Flash Thompson and has all the kids chanting, Penis Parker. It's very good.
Well, Let's talk about some of these characters.
Okay.
Flash, love him. Tony, if you are wondering, where did I see that kid before? He's the kid from the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay.
And yes. I love that their instinct for casting Flash Thompson was, let's go to a Wes Anderson movie. That's amazing. And I had always thought, like, when I heard that casting, I'm like, Tony Revolori seems like kind of a small dude. He's not really a bully. And it's like, well, he's small, but not compared to Tom Holland. So that's how this kind of structure works. No, but he's so good. I love that actor, and he's a lot of fun in this.
I hope that if they make these movies till the end of time, eventually they'll get to the part where Flash Thompson has joined the military and becomes Venom because the military captures the Venom symbiote suit, and so they have him be the special agent.
I honestly, as it's set up, if they want to do Venom at some point, I think you have your character.
Yeah.
That would actually be an interesting use of Venom, and I'm mostly agnostic on Venom and think he's a dumb, boring character. So.
Sure.
Anyway, so that's great. We've got the two love interests in this, sort of. One of them is not overtly a love interest yet, but, I mean, we have Liz, who, and I love how they play on us. They never say Liz Allen.
Yeah.
They just say Liz, so we assume she's Liz Allen. So we don't see the twist with the vulture coming. And it's not. She's Liz Toombs.
Yeah.
You know? And that's great. So, and it is something they do a lot here. Other than Peter and Aunt May, and I guess the Vulture, no one in this movie is their comic book counterpart.
Yeah.
They are, I don't even know if, they say Flash. I don't know if it's Flash Thompson. But it's Flash. It's Liz. It's an MJ, but it's not Mary Jane. And I like that they're very clearly saying, look, we've done Mary Jane. We've done Gwen Stacy. There is no use in trying that again.
Yeah.
We're just going to create new characters. And I love that. Because I think the Liz we get here is a interesting kind of milquetoast, love interest that we have and works well for Peter. And then Zendaya just keeps stealing scenes in the background as this weird kid named Michelle who clearly has a thing for Peter and he does not notice it because he's 16. And at the end of the movie, they do the cheeky little thing where she's called MJ.
Yeah.
And I like that just as a metatextual, a kid like Peter in 2017 wouldn't have the "you hit the jackpot, tiger" moment,
Yeah.
Like, that character doesn't exist.
Yeah, the MJ of the old comic books is very much a character cut from the mold of the 1960s.
Yes.
You do not have, that's even apparent in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies where they, made MJ more sort of, normal. Because old MJ is the product of the sweet 60s,
Yeah.
That's not what the 2000s are like. That's not what the 2010s are like. There are people like that all over the place.
No, but I like that his new exciting love interest, if that's where they're going to go with it, is, kind of a dorky, weird girl, you know? And I think she has interesting chemistry with everyone.
Yeah, she's just very funny. The whole movie is very funny. And it's really strong dialogue for a lot of the characters that they have very distinct voices that comes across in the writing, not just in the performance.
Oh, I mean, and you've got comedians just littered through this movie. You've got Martin Starr as the teacher who's doing the decathlon, and he's a Freaks and Geeks alum, and I thought that was a nice touch to get someone from, because this show definitely has shades of Freaks and Geeks in it. So nice to have him in there. You have Hannibal Buress playing the gym teacher who has all the Captain America videos, which is great.
I think this guy is a war criminal or something now, but I don't know. They just tell me I have to show you these videos.
That might be the best, intertextual reference in the whole Marvel universe.
Because it's you kind of forget that, this is it has to be post-Civil War. So Captain America is on the outs in terms of, officially speaking.
So I love that. And then we talked about Ned. He's so good, and he's such a big figure in this. And I do like that, they don't play, a little bit at the end, and we'll see where they go with it. They don't play the game Amazing Spider-Man did, where they kind of just let everyone in on the secret immediately.
Yeah.
But they do let Ned in on it, and I think it works. It's a lot of fun.
Because I think it's just something where the Sam Raimi movies did the, very isolated Peter Parker thing so perfectly that, you can't just do that again. And I think they do this a lot better than the Amazing Spider-Man movies did, having Gwen know that Peter was Spider-Man, which I think is one of the many storytelling choices they made in those movies that did not work out for them in the long run.
Didn't go anywhere is what it is.
And here I think they make good use of it, and Ned knowing that Peter is Spider-Man is important to the movie and important to how the movie is paced and used.
It's also funny.
Yes, it's
funny. That's the best thing is that Ned is just a fanboy from that point on, and you get that great scene where they're in gym class. And you hear Liz saying, she loves Spider-Man. And Ned just blurts out, Peter knows Spider-Man! Yeah. Which leads...
dude, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah.
Which leads to a moment... And this is why I love how they use Ned in this movie, is it sets up the whole idea that Peter is going to try to go to a party as Spider-Man and Peter. And when they were setting that up, My brother, who was in the movie with me, got annoyed at me because I was, like, moving in my seat. I was so excited that they were going to do this. And ultimately, they don't do the full bore. Like, he's going back and forth. And I am a little disappointed, even though it makes better sense for the movie that they didn't. But I love that they even approached that weird, like, stereotypical sitcom thing.
I mean, it's one of the things that I think is one of the things that makes Ned a useful character, and him knowing about Spider-Man useful in the movie, is that it does set up. I think it helps contrast with Peter and highlights, like, right, Peter takes this seriously. Like, this is, and it's one of the things that I kind of really like, that they don't go into the Uncle Ben stuff at all. Like, they don't address it directly. There's nothing of that. This, like, there's just the little hints about, like, Peter's attitude. I think the biggest tip towards it is when he comes home late that one day and, like, Aunt May is totally freaking out. I feel like that is the one that's like, okay, yeah, she's freaking out because Uncle Ben died, like, 9 months ago or something like that. And they just don't, like, directly say it at any point. But it does highlight, like, in the ways that, in almost in ways that are maybe not good for Peter, of like how serious he is and like how intense the responsibility he feels about Spider-Man is, like contrasted with Ned, who's like, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened. He reacts the way you would expect a normal teenager to react. It's like, dude, like, you're going to be the most popular kid in school. Like, you just have to show up at the party and do the whole Superman thing. It's like, oh, I'm Peter. Like, oh man, I got to go to the bathroom. Hey guys, what's up? I'm Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, but it's a good, it's a strong character choice for Peter to have him, like, go there and ultimately be like, I'm not going to do this because I need to go investigate what this fuck this explosion was. Like, that's what Spider-Man is for. Spider-Man is not for parlor tricks.
And I love that they bring him right up to the line and he ultimately decides that's not responsible. And that's how you write a character.
Exactly.
Let's talk about Peter.
Okay, yeah.
Marvel consistently does their heroes perfectly.
Yeah.
I don't know if, like, since the early days when we got our first glimpse of Thor and Cap and everyone, I felt they got anything this perfectly. Because this is, like, again, an out-of-body, like, they found a real-life Spider-Man cartoon and put him in a movie. They didn't, there's no actor named Tom Holland, but they just ripped someone out of a cartoon and he's in the movie.
Yeah, it is definitely amazing. Like, it's something that it's so refreshing to have. As much as I love the Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man, and I fucking love Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man, do not get me wrong, they made a very good choice in those movies of having him be in high school for like 15 minutes because Tobey Maguire was not in high school when they made those movies. And Tom Holland is like 20 or something. He's a little bit older, but like he looks so young. He plays young so perfectly. And he is, even if you're 20, compared to Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield when they're playing Peter Parker, that is way closer to being the appropriate age. And there's something you can so grasp about the exuberance and youthfulness of Peter Parker from that kind of performance that you just can't necessarily get if the actor's too old.
Here's the thing this movie gets right that no other Spider-Man movie has, and I'm including the Sam Raimi ones. The guy in the costume playing Spider-Man with all the powers and everything feels like he is 100% the same guy walking around at high school having a backpack on. And that is a magic trick.
Yeah.
Because Spider-Man is hard to do on film because he is masked. And it is really hard to get the sense that once he goes under the mask, it's the same guy. Even if it's Andrew Garfield or Tobey Maguire in the costume, that buy-in has always been hard for me.
Yeah.
Like, I think the Amazing Spider-Man movies failed at that uniquely in that once he puts the mask on, he's a weird sociopath, and that's fucked up. Yeah. But even the Sam Raimi movies, I think part of it, he looked taller in the suit than he did out of it. The, like, amount of stunt work they were doing, he just, and even the way he talked and stuff, I always think there was at least something of a disconnect, and there's a reason, I think, for a lot of the best scenes in Spider-Man 2, for instance, they take the mask off.
Yeah.
You know, because it's especially pre, when they could do this thing with the eyes they're doing, it's really hard to have the actor emote through that, and so I think that's something that those movies struggle with a little bit. Here, he is in the Spider-Man costume for, like, at least half the movie. He is... It's kind of like The Dark Knight in that regard, where in The Dark Knight, Christian Bale, I think, is in the Batman suit way more than he is out of it. It's not quite to that level in this, but he is Spider-Man for much of the movie, and instead of feeling like those are scenes where he's just some guy doing stunts, that is Peter Parker developing as a character. And I think it's so much down to the writing is so sharp in those scenes. They put so much thought into, again, he's not just perfect when he gets in the suit. He messes up. He's clumsy. There's that great scene where he's stopping the bank robbery, and he's like, going to lean against the wall, like he's going to be all cool, and he can't quite figure out how to do it. I love those little things. And then just the way Tom Holland delivers all that, you can so hear Peter's voice and exuberance and everything we know about that performance in it. The physicality is so real. And they let Spider-Man in the costume look small. He looks like a kid. He looks short. He looks like he's Tom Holland's size. So when he gets in the costume, he doesn't suddenly buff up and get three times larger. He looks like Tom Holland put on a costume. And I love that. And I do think one of the strokes of genius to this movie is the CGI eyes.
Absolutely,
and getting to move those. That does so much for the performance. And yeah, I think that is the thing that I just noticed right off the bat and carried me through the movie, is that in the costume, out of the costume, it's just Peter Parker. And that is a look, even some of the best superhero movies don't get to do that. Like the Iron Man films, sometimes I feel that when Tony is in the Iron Man costume and they don't like cut in there.
Yeah.
I always find it weird when like I hear dialogue coming out of it. There's just a disconnect. There's no disconnect in this.
Yeah, I think there's like you said, there's a lot of stuff of the eyes is such a huge deal. Like, it's so important because that's always been the trick in Spider-Man comic books is, and in, like, not just Spider-Man, I think it's like a big Batman thing as well, is like having the eyes move to express emotion in the character when they are masked, which obviously, like, a lot of times, like, you would just assume that's never going to work in live action because that looks too weird. I think for Batman, it's an even harder thing to do because Batman does not technically have lenses on his mask. He's just drawn that way 99% of the time. So, like, you know, it's like in the Batman animated series they have in the opening, they have, like, the scene where, it's like, his eyes just narrow. And that communicates so much about the character that in live action, it's just like, well, you can't do that because they're wearing an actual suit. They've got an actual mask on. And for this, they're like, well, fuck that. Like, they came up with a good excuse for being able to do it and have it, like, make, like, textual sense in the movie that he has, like, the more advanced sort of Tony Stark design Spider-Man suit. So, like, the lenses contract and stuff. You don't really understand why they need to do all that, but they can do that. And then that allows you to sort of justify being able to make it expressive. And then I think it's also just in the writing and how they have managed to sort of create this nest of characters like Ned and the AI, Karen, I think her name is, for the suit, that give a character for Peter to bounce off of when he is in the Spider-Man suit, that is so important. Because I think I've seen some people complaining about that stuff of like, but you know, the Spider-Man, normally he's like kind of on his own and he's just talking to himself in his head all the time in the comic books. It's like, in a movie, you can't just do that because the movie would be him like voiceover in his head like half of the fucking movie when he's in the Spider-Man suit, and that does not communicate as well like audio wise for a movie as it would in a comic book or even in like a cartoon. In live action, I think that there's like it would create this like weird sense of like, what the fuck is going on? Like, this is just annoying. It would be like David Lynch's Dune at some point. It's like, why is this, like, everyone's thoughts communicate directly to me 100% of the time? So instead they have designed these two supporting characters that allow Peter to talk and, like, be active and, like, think his, like, have his very Peter Parker dialogue kind of moments as Spider-Man without it feeling awkward in live action and, like, making it so, like, you can have that side of Spider-Man, which is something that none of the other live action Spider-Man movies have been able to do at all because they didn't have that. They didn't have the eyes. They didn't have the other characters. And they rightfully chose not to just have him either talking constantly or, like, narrating constantly to you as if they were, like, the thought balloons in a Spider-Man comic book.
And the Amazing Spider-Man movies half-heartedly tried it.
Sure,
but what they didn't understand is they just had him, like, quip at random times, even when it seemed wildly out of character to do so. And in this movie, I think what they get is Peter's a chatterbox when he's nervous.
Yeah.
He's not a chatterbox out of a influx of confidence, you know?
Right.
That is not why Peter Parker is a chatterbox. And that's what Amazing Spider-Man tried to do, is like, oh, he's so confident. It's like, you guys have never read a Spider-Man comic, you idiots. But no, it's like he's nervous and what happens when Peter is in a really tough situation in this movie? He shuts the hell up.
Yeah.
He gets to work. Like in the ferry scene when everything is going to hell, why that scene is powerful is he's not quipping.
Yeah.
He seems different because he is reacting to his surroundings and they have set it up contextually. And I can't believe we even have to explain why that's a problem, but the Amazing Spider-Man movies really didn't get it.
Yeah, exactly.
So like, it's important. And yeah, I love the whole Karen character. Did you know she's voiced by Jennifer Connelly?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's very good. Because that allows, like, you have that whole great sequence in the middle of the movie where he's stuck in that like weird bunker or whatever with all the storage containers. And it's like a 5 to 10, 15 minute scene of this movie of him being totally on his own, just talking to Karen, practicing being Spider-Man in this room. And it was just like, it was one of those scenes where you're like, the Sam Raimi movies and the Amazing Spider-Man movies could not have done a scene like this. And this scene does so much for, like you said, like, let you buy that Spider-Man and Peter Parker, like, that's the same person. Like, that person is in that suit. Like, they are not going 100% different. It's the same human being. Like, and having him be on his own and just be in the suit the whole time really sells that perfectly.
Another thing I want to mention on that note is sound design, I think, is important to this. He sounds muffled through the mask. Yeah. And a lot of movies don't want to do that for, I think, understandable reasons. But having just that slight amount of it does sound like someone talking through a mask adds to that buy-in.
Yeah.
That he is a kid in the suit. It's not, he goes in the suit and becomes a superhero. You know, it's just him. And I think there's little touches like that throughout the movie where I think it's very thoughtfully made. Even if I don't think, like I said, it's the most cinematic version of Spider-Man, I think it's a very thoughtfully made movie.
Yeah.
And I love all of that about it. So yeah, Tom Holland, man, he is just a damn good actor.
Yeah, because they give him so much to do. Like, he has to be funny, and he has to be dramatic, he has to be sad, he has to be angry. Like, I think this is another thing about that this movie gets is that young Peter Parker also, like, has a lot of anger issues sometimes, and like that I think they get across well here.
He just has this whole great physicality where he does feel like a kid who is, like, bursting with energy. Like, it's ripping him apart in scenes where it's like he just needs to get it out. Like,
he's got all those damn hormones.
He does. And you know, it's like early in the movie, I love their whole opening with this, after all the vlogging sequence and everything, which we'll get to, is you see him at school, and he is, like, nervously counting down the minutes until he can just get out of there, go get his sandwich at the deli, which is a wonderful, charming little sequence, and then go be Spider-Man, because if you were Spider-Man, you would want to get the hell out of school and go be Spider-Man, you know? And it's just little things like that that I love how much they give us all that. And even then, it's not the super polished version of that sequence, you know? Like, when he goes to suit up, he goes in the back alley, and he's very clumsy through all of it.
Yeah.
And I love that Tom Holland was willing to get down to his underwear in multiple scenes here and be very vulnerable on screen.
I love that's one of the smartest scenes in the whole movie, is just in this, just this extended shot held on him in that alleyway of him just having to change, go from, you know, because again, it doesn't cut at all. So you just see the whole process of him running out of school, going into the alleyway, and having to go from Peter Parker, the high school teenager, to Spider-Man. And it's like an awkward fumbling process where he throws his backpack, and it's like has to rip off his clothes and all this stuff, and like throws his shoes over. And then I love the, like, puts on the full suit and has to, like, put each leg in. And, you know, Spider-Man puts on his pants one leg at a time, just like the rest of us. And he puts the whole suit on. I love how it's, like, super baggy, and then he has to, like, hit the thing, and it goes, and it becomes skin tight. It's very good.
It's very good. And I love that what we get out of that sequence is that his thing that he is constantly brushing up against Aunt May for is he's losing his backpack.
Yeah, because his backpack keeps on getting stolen.
Yep. And that's just, because it's like there's something Aunt May always has to notice of, like, something going wrong in Peter's life. And I like that for this movie, it's mostly the backpack.
Yeah.
And that's just a great little touch. Speaking of Aunt May,
yeah,
I think Marissa Tomei is great in this.
Yes.
She and Tom Holland have great chemistry. I wish there was more of her.
Sure,
I think, not like a ton, I think we needed one scene, and they almost get there, but I think it cuts too early, of just an elongated scene, just the two of them, give us their relationship.
Right.
You know, Rosemary Harris is not in the first two Spider-Man movies a ton. Like, she's not in every scene, but you have those scenes where she and Peter sit down and talk, and you really get a feeling for how they are as you know, a not mother and son, but mother figure and son figure, you know. And I think we were just missing maybe a scene of full length at that, but I think she's very good. I agree probably with some criticisms that I think they lean into the, oh my god, she's hot joke a little too much.
Yeah, there's like one or too many times. Like, you can do it once, because I think, like, you almost have to do it once if people have seen the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies and be like, yes, this is supposed to be the same character. Like, you have to kind of lampshade it a little bit so that people are like, right, Aunt May, not super old lady in this one. Okay.
Yeah, and Marissa Tomei also is a uniquely gorgeous person.
Sure, yes.
You know, there's that of that, like, we have all been watching Marissa Tomei on screen for 20, 30 years, and she has de-aged. She's a Benjamin Button person, and it's, you know, it's a unique thing going on there. But yeah, I got out of that movie wanting to see more of Aunt May. Like, I want to see, like, how her life kind of progresses, because, again, they're not playing her as Rosemary Harris, kind of, you know, old person in the sunset of their years. She has a long life ahead of her. I want to see what her life is going to be like, you know? Especially with this crazy nephew of hers.
Yeah.
It's interesting, and she's a good character. So, yeah, talking about other characters in the movie, I mean, we can talk about the kind of holdovers we have, and we have Happy Hogan, and we have the Tony Stark.
Oh, right, yeah. So and then you get a little bit of Pepper at the end of the movie, too.
Which was very surprising.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that just right now. this is how much Marvel was pissing on Sony's territory, is that we're not just going to bring in Pepper Potts here. We're going to wrap up part of Tony Stark's character arc in Sony's Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
That felt like so they're just pissing on that territory. And I loved it. I did, because Gwyneth Paltrow, I think, has been maybe too noticeably absent from the last couple. She was in Iron Man 3, but then not in Avengers or Civil War. And it was like, I felt like we should have seen her somewhere. And it was nice to see that and just get like, okay, she and Tony got back together. That's nice.
Yeah, I like that there's like this weird, like, it's like the Iron Man movies are like the big brother for the Spider-Man movies now. And I like that. Like, I like, because it's one of the handful of things about like this, the like comic book Civil War story stuff that I really liked was Tony Stark taking Peter Parker, who at the time, like in the comics, he was would have been in his early 20s, or he would have been 50. It's like, how does comic book time work? I don't fucking know. But like, he was an older Peter Parker, but still, like, Tony Stark sort of took him under his wing, because there is, I think, like, the writers very correctly identified in the comic book Civil War storylines when they made that choice, that there are similarities between Tony Stark and Peter Parker. They're both, like, awkward, nerdy science guys that have some, like, confidence and anger issues that they partially expressed through their superhero activities. And then, obviously, Tony then also has, like, his drinking stuff and all that on top of it. But I think there are commonalities between those two characters that is really interesting to put them together and have Tony Stark be this like kind of weird pseudo father figure for Peter, because very famously Peter lost his main father figure, Uncle Ben, and that's one of the reasons he's Spider-Man. And I think this movie does justice to that idea so well, and I was very happy to see, like, yes, I loved that story idea. It was never explored in the way it needed to be in the comic books when they kind of played with it a little bit, because it was consumed, as with all the good ideas in the comic book Civil War, it was consumed by the mass of the Civil War crossover. And here, I think they just do a great job of getting the sense of, like, one, Spider-Man absolutely exists in this universe. He exists in relation to all these characters, and it makes sense how he fits here. And then, two, like, he does have a particular relationship to Tony Stark that says a lot about Peter and also says a lot about Tony. And it's fun just because we love Tony Stark from those movies as well, and so it's cool to see him here.
And to see him from that other angle, you know? I think the key is they don't use him too much. He's in like four scenes. He's good in all those scenes. All those scenes say something about Peter more than it does about Tony. But I like that progression. I do like him as this like father figure who's kind of distant out there. What it reminded me of, in a weird parallel, is Dumbledore in the early Harry Potter books.
Sure.
Where in the early Harry Potter books, you always have Harry, Ron, and Hermione solving some mystery at Hogwarts. And it's something that Dumbledore apparently can't be bothered with, even though, of course, if he came in, he could solve it in a second.
Right.
But he's not. And then at the end of the book, or like middle of the book, Harry has done something crazy, and Dumbledore has to like, you shouldn't have done that, Harry. And then at the end, he's like, oh, you saved the day, Harry. I'm a little sorry about that. And that's exactly what Iron Man is here. I love that it's like that kind of archetype where, you know, Peter absolutely makes mistakes in this, but he is trying to do the right thing. And you have the authority figure who's, you know, mostly being supportive, but also maybe isn't seeing the forest for the trees.
Yeah, and he just like, it's like Iron Man's trying to be a supportive father figure, but he doesn't quite know how to be. And it's like, he sort of believes Peter, but he doesn't believe Peter enough. And it's like, he doesn't see that he's not giving Peter enough attention. And that's like a big part of the movies. He's just like, I want to be out there. Like, I want to be able to do this stuff. I feel like I'm not being used to my full potential. And like, getting complete silence means that he's just going to keep on acting out more and more.
I also think that scene after the fairy incident, where Peter is railing against Iron Man, and he thinks once again that Tony has just come in a, you know, robo costume, and instead Tony just walks out of the thing.
Yeah.
It's a moment kind of ruined by the trailers, but I think it lands perfectly in that it's surprising, it's intimidating. Robert Downey Jr. always gives it 100%, and this is no exception to that, and he is great. He's kind of like shaking with anger, but also disappointment in that he's mad at himself so much in that scene. I think you can tell of like, I wish I hadn't like put this kid in this position or something, because now I have to take it away. And I think that's a great scene. And then the end where he's, you know, offering to make him an Avenger and all that is wonderful. And a great moment in his character arc that Peter gets what he always wanted, which was to be an Avenger, and realizes that's not what he really wants, which is a, you know, archetypal ending, but it works very well.
Yeah.
And then we do get a lot of Jon Favreau in this.
Yeah, like it feels like it's the most we've got of Happy since like maybe like Iron Man 2. I feel like I haven't seen 3 since it was in the theaters, but I feel like he wasn't in that movie that much.
I feel like he wasn't in it as much because he wasn't directing that one, so he wasn't on set every day, I guess. But yeah, no, it was a good amount of Happy, and I like that he is kind of the beleaguered, you know, in-between guy between these two giant personalities.
Yeah.
So that was fun. And yeah, seeing Gwyneth Paltrow again was good. So The one character we have left to talk about, of course, is Michael motherfucking Keaton.
Yes, as the Adrian Toomes, the Vulture.
Man, okay, I know it's easy to just think about, like, Venom in Spider-Man 3, or the shit that is Amazing Spider-Man 2. Ignore those two things. I think the Spider-Man movies have a pretty great track record with their villains.
Yeah, because considering that most comic book movies do not do the villains particularly well because they have to spend so much time getting the hero character right, which is where like the prime concern should be. They don't have enough time to be like, well, like, what's Red Skull's deal? It's like, he's a Nazi asshole. Like, you could make a more interesting story, but we have to spend so much time being like, Captain America's way more important. But yeah, I think the Spider-Man movies, particularly like, you know, Spider-Man 1 and Spider-Man 2... like, do such a good job, particularly Spider-Man 2. Like, Dr. Octopus is fucking awesome in that movie.
And Willem Dafoe is a beautiful work of mad genius.
Yeah. So it's
or
like
a mad work of beautiful genius, I don't know.
And then also, like, the lizard in Amazing Spider-Man 1 was one of the better parts of that movie.
One of the better parts of that movie, and I will always stand up for Thomas Hayden Church in Spider-Man 3. I think his Sandman is good, if not perfectly used.
Yeah, like, he was, if they did not have all the other shit that the studio shoved into that movie with Venom in the black suit... his Sandman in Spider-Man 3 would have been a great fucking villain.
He's good in every one of his scenes. Yeah. So, but yeah, and I think Michael Keaton lives up to that legacy.
Absolutely. He's one of the strongest villains in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Number two to Loki, probably.
Yes. There's not a lot of competition.
No. And he's used sparingly. Like, there's a big opening scene where we get his origin story, and he's good in that. But I tweeted this, and I think it's true. I think you have to wait to see why they cast Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
And why they cast Michael Keaton is for the scenes when Peter goes to Liz's house for homecoming and everyone in the theater shits their pants because it's evil Michael Keaton as her father. That is one of the great surprises in any superhero movie.
That was the scene that, like, I was enjoying the movie a lot up to that point, but I think that scene, like, clicked the whole movie into place for me. It was, like, in a way that was, like, more than just, like, this is an entertaining movie, but, like, this is a really good Spider-Man movie. Is like, that is the most Spider-Man Peter Parker fucking thing to ever happen. It's like, everything is going great. Like, not everything is going great. Like, he fucked up with, like, the barge, but it's like, you know, like, I finally, like, this girl I like, said, like, yes, we'll go to the dance together. It's like, man, things are looking up for Peter Parker. Maybe I don't need to do all this Spider-Man shit. Things are fine, like, da-da-da-da-da, I got my suit, I've got my corsage, I got all this stuff, going to prom or homecoming dance with Liz, this girl I've liked forever, open up the door, and it's fucking Vulture standing there. It's like, oh, god damn it.
It's so great. And, you know, the other thing it reminded me of, this is something I felt throughout the whole movie, is this really feels influenced by Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Sure, yeah.
And that was the moment that most felt like a Buffy scene to me, in that you're taking, it's that Joss Whedon idea, which is very influenced by Spider-Man, obviously. But I do think that's kind of a modern touchstone of it, is that Joss Whedon idea of taking a normal teenage scenario that is scary and heightening it through the fantasy.
Yeah.
And so, like, oh man, I'm really scared to meet my date's dad. Oh god, it's Michael Keaton Vulture. Like, that is such a brilliant touch. And I think they play it so well, where there is so much tension and terror throughout all of that. Tom Holland plays it so well, where he is, I think, holding himself together as well as a person possibly could under those circumstances. And through this normal little chit-chat, accidentally gets revealed that he's Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I honestly think Michael Keaton in that series of scenes, that is far and away the most menacing any Marvel villain has ever been.
Absolutely.
Like, Loki is a fun villain. He's not that scary.
Yeah, what it does is, like, it just does the perfect Spider-Man villain thing. It's like, it's one of the things that Spider-Man 1 with the Green Goblin does so well, is, like, you create this distance between, like, the problem that Spider-Man has to deal with and the problems that Peter Parker has to deal with are different. It's like, Peter Parker has to deal with the rent, he has to deal with his girlfriend, he has to deal with this. Spider-Man has to fight the Green Goblin, Spider-Man has to fight Vulture, and all these problems are really, like, pressing. But they are separated, and you both, like Spider-Man the character and you the reader or audience, like, are part of this, like, cognitive thing where you can just separate these two things and kind of, like, compartmentalize them. And then when it all comes crashing down and the villain invades, like, Peter's personal life and his personal space the way that Green Goblin does in Spider-Man 1, and then now the way that the Vulture does in Spider-Man Homecoming, it's fucking terrifying, because all of a sudden it's like, like, your armor just, like, goes away. It's just like, oh god, like, there's nowhere else you can go. Like, you could, like, this is the worst possible scenario you could ever imagine for this character. is like his arch nemesis now in his real life.
And talking about good screenwriting, I think keeping Keaton in the background for acts 1 and 2 is 100% the right choice, because once he is a big part of the movie, he gets to bite into it, and he is great. And it also means that the stakes feel so much higher, and it means that they save something for the third act, which is such a big problem in these movies. The third act of Homecoming is great and feels like it's building organically on what we had before, because he hasn't really, he's seen Vulture, he's been beaten up by Vulture, but he hasn't gone toe-to-toe with him. He doesn't know who he is yet. So when we actually get that convergence in the third act, it's perfect.
Yeah. And it's something that, like, one of the reasons why the twist works as well as it does is that even while he doesn't have, like, a bunch of huge standout scenes in Act 1 and 2, like Michael Keaton's Vulture, the things we do get of him set up this twist so perfectly. Like, the thing he keeps on reinforcing is, like, I'm doing this for, like, both, like, my employees, because, you know, they set up at the beginning that's, like, he has all these people working for him that he's responsible for as a construction guy, and so then when he can't get construction work and he has to turn to crime, he's doing it both for them and to pay their way and to support them because they've supported him, but also he has a family he needs to support. And he says that, like, 5 or 6 times, so when that door opens and you see him standing there, you understand immediately what is happening, and you understand immediately his motivations, and you understand now Peter's motivations, and you, like, that whole situation crystallizes perfectly because they've set it up.
And he's a genuinely interesting character. He's not an evil, maniacal villain.
Yeah.
He really is more almost in the Doc Ock mold, where it's a kind of a benign thing that went too far.
Yeah.
I mean, Doc Ock from Spider-Man 2. Doc Ock in the comics is a maniacal bastard.
He's a piece of shit. Yeah. He's just gonna kill people.
But no, I love that, like, this Adrian Toomes, this is, you know, he had a construction job, and he was probably a good, decent family man. And then that got kind of torn away from him, so he started doing this, and it probably seemed benign at first, and it grew and grew and grew. And he's still been able to keep it as, like, that's his 9-to-5, and then he goes home, and he has the lovely wife and kid, and he has a good life. But now it's like the pressure is rising, and he keeps resisting doing the big job with the Avengers plane. Like, he does have lines, he doesn't want to hurt people, he doesn't, you know, like, he, obviously the guns will get somewhere bad, but in his own line of work, he's not trying to murder people, he's not completely maniacal. And he just kind of winds up going too far step by step. And I love that. And I love that it allows Peter to show his own humanity to a villain at the end of the movie and have that reciprocated. Because, you know, you do have, he's able to save Vulture. Vulture doesn't die. Vulture goes to prison. And he has that scene in the mid-credits where he winds up protecting Peter's identity. Because deep down, this Adrian Toomes is not a rat bastard.
Yeah, he's not incorruptibly evil, you know. It's almost like another fun, if they want to keep on doing Netflix TV shows, is now they can just do Breaking Bad but with the Vulture, because that's basically, he's basically Walter White. Like, he starts from this place of good intentions and, like, kind of like trying to help out his family, and then it slowly builds up, and because he has, like, anger issues and like maybe he does not have the, like, requisite amount of empathy to, like, not, like, you know, completely break down when he sees someone die, he just, like, keeps on going until it gets to this point where it's like, dude, like, you don't need, like, have you seen your fucking house, man? You don't need to do this shit anymore. And it's like, I think they do such a good job of characterizing him very subtly that way, and without having to, like, focus on him for, like, half the movie, they let you know who this guy is. He has a lot more complexity to him than a Red Skull or, like, you know, I mean, most of the villains in the Marvel movies are really straightforward. Here, he's got something to him, and he has, like you said, he has boundaries. He's not just going to try to destroy the world. He's not just going to murder 100 people. Like, he has a very clear objective that isn't just generic comic book villain, I'm going to just destroy the world or something.
Yeah, it's a really good arc, and Michael Keaton is so good. Like, it's worth repeating. He is fully engaged. He is awesome in this, and I do think the scenes, once he and Peter know who each other are, oh, he's menacing. Like, the other scene where Peter, you know, chases him down after that great car chase and everything, and he gets to the foot of the building and everything, and they're there, and it's the scene where Vulture is killing time until he brings the thing in. He is scary. He feels like he is desperate, and he will pop a cap in this kid if he has to, and he has no scruples about that.
Yeah.
You know? And it's great. And I love that it does build up, like, he has that one moment where he tries to kill Peter, and when he has the chance to do it again, he can't.
Yeah.
It's a good evolution for him. And I Michael Keaton has been in more movies lately. He is not in enough movies.
Yes,
We need Michael Keaton in more things.
He's so fucking good in this. Another thing they do, I think that's really smart with the Vulture, in terms of, like, I think there's more going on in Spider-Man Homecoming thematically than some of the Marvel movies do, that I really like. It's not a super heavy theme, but it's definitely there, of that these are, like, working class people. Like, Peter and Michael Keaton, they're working class. He's a working class villain. Peter's a working class hero. Like, he's the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. And it's like, Peter's arc is about, like, trying, having to understand that in a way that, like, kind of maybe Vulture's arc is almost about that. Like, Vulture's arc is about having to be like, you can't, like, you trying to be this thing is destroying you because you're trying to go about it the wrong way. Like, you trying to be this, like, Tony Stark figure or something and trying to, like, live in that world in like this, like, accelerated crazy way, like, that fucking destroys you. In the same way that, like, Peter's like, you are not that person yet, or maybe you never will be, and maybe that's not who you need to be. You don't have to be the guy who goes and, like, stops the fucking alien invasion. You, like, also need the person who's on the street corner that stops the bank robbery, you know? And, like, that's important, and understanding that is important. And I think, like, there is a confluence there in how, and a sort of pairing between the Vulture and Peter about why the Vulture is an appropriate enemy for Peter to fight as opposed to Ultron, you know?
Exactly. And, yeah, also we're saying, I think the Vulture suit is cool.
Yes.
I like that. I like that there's a sense of, like, weight to it, like it's a big flight suit. I like that, you know, Michael Keaton is an older guy, and they kind of recognize that, like, this is not his favorite thing to go do in the world.
Yeah.
That, like, when he gets off of it, he's kind of sore, and, you know, it's obviously physically exerting for him. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of smart touches there. At the end of the movie, with the big plane scene where he gets, like, the bigger wings, that's just cool.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, most of the Spider-Man villains they have tried to adapt, they've done well with.
Yeah.
Across the different versions of the movies, and Vulture is no exception. Sometimes better than I've seen them done in cartoons and stuff. You know,
sure,
I think Vulture is a more dynamic version of the character than at least I've been exposed to in other versions.
Yeah.
So I like that, and I'm excited. They also technically have a version of Shocker here.
Yeah.
And given that Shocker is like the shittiest Spider-Man villain, I love that they just make him a henchman in this. And he's played by Bokeem Woodbine, who I was trying to figure out who it was the whole movie. And he was on season 2 of Fargo as Mike Mulligan. And he is a great actor. And I thought he was really fun as this version of Shocker.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Yeah. They set up briefly Matt Gargan as the Scorpion. That's like...
That's who he is,
the mid-post-credit sequence. And it's something they do. And there's a lot of, like, little touches throughout the whole movie of, like, little references to Spider-Man stuff, which is fun for me because, like, I know way more about Spider-Man than I do any other superhero. So it's like, while sometimes they make those references in, like, a Guardians of the Galaxy movie, I'm not usually going to pick it up. Here it's like, oh, that's Betty Brant on, like, the school announcement system, and she was in the, like, comics, and she's also in the Sam Raimi movies. She's J. Jonah Jameson's, like, receptionist. So it's like little references like that. Or in, like, for the first half of the movie, whenever they cut to the Vulture, they keep on very quietly in the background building up to this, like, a Gargan deal for, like, the tail, which is like them, Matt Gargan is the Scorpion, so it's like they're slowly setting up that, and I think that's smart.
Yeah.
Cool.
No, a lot of stuff this movie does well. What else should we talk about? Let's talk about some of the action scenes.
Sure, yeah.
Again, I don't think they're, like, the best shot in the world. I do think they're imaginative, and I think in most cases, I think they say a lot about the character, and that's what I care about most.
Yeah, they get across well that this is not a super experienced Peter Parker, and he's very, like, he's fumbling around trying to figure out how is he going to, like, stop this elevator, which is, like, it's not this, like, huge, crazy, it's not like Iron Man fighting the Hulk in, like, Avengers 2 or something. It's this very small-scale problem. It's not even, like, you know, Spider-Man in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man having to, like, stop the two things that Green Goblin is dropping to try to save these people. It's just like, there's this elevator in here that is about to fall. How do I get into the fucking Washington Monument and stop this elevator? It's like a really small problem that he has to work really hard to try to solve.
And I thought that was the best action sequence in terms of staging and editing and everything. Like, I think it's very imaginatively staged. I like the different phases of it, of him trying to get up the fucking Washington Monument, which is a very imaginative thing.
Yeah.
That's actually something they do a lot in this movie that I enjoy, is that question of, like, if Spider-Man's not in the boroughs of New York, what does he do? And, like, so you have, like, him going through the neighborhood, and that's really tough, and you have him like, fuck, I can't get up this fucking monument because there's no other buildings around, and things like that. I think the whole thing of the helicopters being there and him having to use the wingsuit thing and then, like, jump through the window, I think it's very imaginatively staged, so I like that one. On the other side, I think you have, you know, the one at the end with the plane that I think I love the imagination of it, of this plane that like has the malfunctioning like cloaking device or whatever, and you have him, you know, trying to stay on the plane, and he's in his like hoodie suit, and all of that is interesting. I think that scene is way too cutty, like it's constantly cutting. I think it's too close up in the frame, and I don't think it uses the widescreen frame all that well for that, and it's a little visually confusing. I wasn't sure where things were all the time, but it was a fun sequence. Again, it's I haven't seen Spider-Man stop a plane, so that was cool. But then I do think the standout is in the middle of the movie, the barge thing. Again, it's not like it's the best action scene ever. On a character level, I love how that whole thing goes down, where Peter starts off too cocky and he makes a mistake, and this whole thing starts going to hell. And once he realizes how bad this is, I love how Tom Holland plays that in the suit of just panic. Like, what the fuck is going on? How do I see? He's never been, you know, like, he had to save one person in the Washington Monument, and he cared about that person. But it's different than here, where it's like there's all these random people he might be responsible for the deaths of, and he is trying so hard to stop it, and he can't. That was great.
Yeah. It's just, it's a very, again, it's a very Spider-Man moment of like, it's, I love when in superhero movies they can manage to really zero in on saving people being the objective, which is one of the reasons why the Washington Monument scene works really well, and this scene works fantastically, and it, you know, it called back to one of the things that Sam Raimi did really well, is like, that was a big part of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, is like, it's not just about stopping Green Goblin or Dr. Octopus, it's about saving people, because that's why you're trying to stop Green Goblin and Dr. Octopus, and keeping that in mind is really important and allows you to have action sequences that are not just you beating the crap out of someone. Yeah. It's about, you know, this creative situation of like, okay, fuck, this barge just like split in half down the middle, in the middle of the river. How do I stop this? And like desperately trying to sort of figure this thing out with the web. And I love this, like, he almost does it. Like, he's so close, and you just notice, like, you don't have quite, you're like not quite there to be able to pull this off yet.
Yeah, and but he tries, and like after it breaks down the first time, he gets in the middle, and he's willing to have his body torn apart if it will come to that.
Yeah.
And that's Spider-Man. Yeah. Like, when he's in the gauntlet, he will go all the way. And I love that. So it's great. And then again, where that goes on a character level with him losing the suit and everything, just very good. So and the movie is so well paced. It moves at a good clip. I don't think this is a great Michael Giacchino score, but it's a decent one. I do like the use of the Spider-Man 60s theme song in the beginning. I almost wish they would have just used it throughout, because it's a better kind of main theme than what I think the rest of the movie uses. But it is a slick, good, really fun, sweet movie.
Another scene to, I think, kind of go to thinking about like action scenes and those kinds of scenes that we haven't talked about yet is at the end of the movie before he fights Vulture and the building has collapsed on him.
Oh, that's a great scene.
It's a great scene, and it's the first time they have like sort of directly done a version of what is like a really famous classic Spider-Man scene, which is, I don't remember which issue it's from, but it's, he's been like crushed under all this shit and someone's going after Aunt May, and like Aunt May's in the hospital. He's like, I just have to push this stuff off. And it's just a really remarkable piece of comic book making, because it's just Steve Ditko like writing, like, it's like 5 to 6 pages of him just trapped under the stuff, like desperately trying to just like launch, like just get this stuff up enough so he can escape. And it's a really classic, brilliant scene. And I love that they adapted it here. And I think they make a good use of it. And it not being exactly the same, but is using the sort of the mechanics of the scene of, this is where he has to like just like fully let it go. And he's totally on his own. He has nothing else. It's one of the reasons why having Karen and Ned throughout the movie works really well, is because it makes it so that when Spider-Man is alone, because we're so accustomed to Spider-Man being alone as a character, when he's not alone for most of the movie, you get used to being like, oh, he has people that he can rely on. And when that is stripped away from him, then he has to be like, this is sort of a moment of truth. It's when he's being tested. It's like, you have nothing else. Like, Iron Man's not going to save you this time. Ned's not going to be able to help you. Karen's not going to be able to help you. You just have to do this and just lift and like believe in yourself enough to be able to get out of this situation. And they do it really well.
And Tom Holland is outstanding in that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a great scene, and I think one that you could, I was in a, you know, really big kind of sold out opening night theater, and lots of laughs and everything throughout the movie. Silence in that scene that really, I think, took people's breath away. And
when he screams scene, like, help, like, someone help me, like, he, that's where you really feel like, oh, this, he's like 17 or 16 years old, like, this is a kid.
They do a great job with it. The movie builds so well to that conclusion. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit like where the movie kind of ends and what we might see in the future?
Sure.
So what did you think about the choice to end the movie with Aunt May seeing him in the suit?
It's hard to tell, like, what they're going to do with it. Like, when I saw that, I just assumed that he would... Because it's not like that would be something that would be hard to explain. Like, I got this Halloween costume. Like I got the Stark internship back, and Mr. Stark sent me this cool Spider-Man costume as a, like, thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think... I did not immediately assume that that means that Aunt May is just going to know he's Spider-Man in the next movie.
Yeah, I think the only thing it mirrors for me is it's very much a mirror, obviously, of the end of the first Iron Man with I Am Iron Man, right, hard sure, cut, yeah. You know? And that obviously really changed the trajectory for Iron Man in a very smart way. I don't think it's smart to have Aunt May know he's Spider-Man, especially yeah. because it ruins the intrigue of she obviously knows he's Spider-Man, which is yeah. a great Aunt May character trait. But yeah, I kind of want to see what they're going to do with it. My only problem is as the end of a movie... It's the thought of, like, well, when are we going to see more of that? Because his next two appearances are in Avengers movies.
Right.
And then we'll finally get another Spider-Man movie. But it's like, that's a long time for a fairly fundamental character thing to be kind of wrapped up, unless we just assume he talks his way out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I... It took me out of the movie a little more than I would have liked. I don't know if I loved that as a final beat for the film.
For me, like, it was just, like, who knows, maybe that will be, like, she does know that he's Spider-Man. But for me, like, in the moment, I immediately read it as being, like... As it not being she knows he's Spider-Man, but it just being like, whenever it's you have to do this with Peter Parker. It's the Parker luck. Whenever anything is ever going good for him, you have to slam it in his face.
Yeah.
It's like, no matter what it is, even if like this is not going to resolve in anything bad, ultimately, or like her even really knowing, it's like, you just have to slam it in his face every single time. It's for whatever reason. That's just what Peter Parker is. I felt like that's just kind of like that movie doing that at the last moment.
I totally agree on that level. It works wonderfully. And it did get a big laugh out of me because yeah. they cut on Aunt May saying the F word, which yeah. Rosemary Harris never said fuck in a Spider-Man movie. Bless her heart.
I mean, but she thought it when Green Goblin was it, like, she never said it, but in her head, she's like, you fucking piece of shit, you motherfucker. I'm going to cut you up, you bitch, you green piece of shit.
Trying to imagine sweet Rosemary Harris yeah. saying any of those words. I don't think she ever has. Anyway.
You just don't know her the way I do.
Yeah, so I think on that level, works perfectly. I you know, there's the 100 serialized levels that right. I'm thinking about. But yeah, no, it's a nice little ending. So we have that mid-credit scene we already talked about with Michael Mando from Better Call Saul playing
Matt Gargan
there. Yeah. So, I noticed him in an earlier scene and I'm like, he's a pretty good actor. Why would they get him for like this cameo? And then it's like, oh, they're setting up something in the post-credits. I did very much like the post-credits sting with Captain America.
Yes.
And just making fun of post-credits scenes. Yeah. That was good.
And it was just like a really good callback to, I think, what was one of the better jokes in the movie, which is all these weird Captain America. Like, it's such a fucking Captain America thing.
Yep.
Like, I know you're going through some changes.
I loved that. I loved that they were just randomly showing it in detention.
Yeah.
I love how Chris Evans plays that. Oh, he's wonderful.
How more of these things do we have to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was a lot of fun. I mean, there's very few things in this movie I didn't enjoy immensely. It is a really, really fun Spider-Man movie. And I don't know if it is as good or better than the first two Sam Raimis. Basically, my conclusion is I can't compare them. They're
sure,
so different as films. You know, I don't think it has the impact of a Spider-Man 2.
No.
Or maybe the ingenuity of a Spider-Man 1. But I do think it is what we, kind of in our wildest dreams, this is what we could have wanted from a Marvel Cinematic Universe Spider-Man.
It's what the Amazing Spider-Man movie should have been.
Yeah.
And, like, they were so misguided. And then, luckily, they weren't, because that meant that terrible Spider-Man franchise died young so that Marvel could get it and be like, okay, like, we have been doing Spider-Man literally since the 60s. We can do Spider-Man.
Yep. No, I said this to Tom, but to my brother after the movie, is that I noted that, like, oh, I saw Amazing Spider-Man 2 in the same theater or something, and Thomas said, was like, everyone miserable? And I'm like, probably. And like, and I said, the one person who probably enjoyed watching Amazing Spider-Man 2 was Kevin Feige, the producer of Marvel, who probably was sitting there with his popcorn cackling like, they messed it all up! They're gonna have me come in! This is great! They fucked it up so bad!
Yeah.
We finally get to make a Spider-Man movie! This couldn't work out any better for us!
He's just saying this, like, did these fuckers not watch Spider-Man 3? Don't put 500 villains in your fucking movie!
It's great. I mean, it really is, though. This whole movie is made with just a sense of joy in its creation. Like,
yeah.
Marvel is like, we get to do it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm so excited to see Tom Holland in the Avengers films. I want to see this Peter Parker meet Rocket Raccoon.
Yeah. It's another in a long, long line of Marvel movies where one of the most fun things about it coming out of the movie theater is being like, I can't wait to see the character crossover with other characters we haven't seen him with yet. Because luckily we have gotten some crossover with him in Civil War, and that was great. And now I want to really go back and rewatch Captain America Civil War now that we know this version of Spider-Man even better.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things that you can like tell how successful the Marvel Cinematic Universe thing is every time they introduce a new character, one, they absolutely nail it, and then two, they're always have these fun personalities that you can immediately in your imagination pair off with who they've already introduced.
Yeah, absolutely. And this could not have worked out any better for Marvel if they had planned it. They get, you know, they don't get to make money off this particular Spider-Man movie, but it is hundreds of millions of dollars of free marketing for the next Avengers.
Yeah.
They got to make a really good movie on someone else's dime. They get to use him in their Avengers movies. Like, everyone wins in this scenario. It's wonderful. It's an actual compromise where everyone comes out happy, and I love it.
Yes, and the people who come out happiest is us.
Yes.
We finally get to talk about a Spider-Man movie on this podcast that's not just utter dog shit.
Yeah, if you go back to the history, we reviewed both Amazing Spider-Mans on here, but then also, like, I think episode 3 of this show was a retrospective on the Raimi films.
Yeah.
So, we talked about them at some point, but they weren't new.
No, yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah, I'm excited. Marvel is having a good year. We had Guardians 2, which is great. This is great, and I'm so looking forward to Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, Thor Ragnarok.
They also showed the Black Panther trailer with this. That looks good on the big screen.
Yeah, that's such a good trailer.
I can't wait.
Although it was sort of the impact of that trailer was somewhat lessened by the fact that the theater fucking showed like 20 minutes of trailers. I feel like it's just this curse of every time you go and see a movie, it just gets longer.
Do you go to like Regal theaters?
Yeah, because it's just so close.
I know they're close, but that's one of the things that I never go there just because they keep upping their trailers.
It is absurd at some point.
Yeah. I drive longer to get to the movies, but I'd rather drive than watch a bunch of fucking trailers at some point. No, I get it. So anything else to say about Spider-Man or should we move on?
It's very good. Let's move on.
All right. Well, if this couldn't be any more different, let's talk about Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, is not Spider-Man. If you didn't know, Twin Peaks is very much not...
There is something about this fucking insanity that is this Twin Peaks that, like, Spider-Man could show up and I would accept it. I'd be like, okay, sure. I don't know. Yeah, okay.
Okay. So, Sean, Twin Peaks Part 9... subtitled on Showtime. I've been taking note of these because these are basically our unofficial episode titles. This one is called This Is the Chair.
Yeah.
Which I love their little descriptions. But anyway, spoilers from here on out. Twin Peaks Part 9. If you haven't seen it, go see it.
Yes. Make sure you've watched all the other ones first because it would be very confusing if you started with this one.
No. Start with Part 8. And if you're okay with that, then watch everything. No, I'm kidding. But speaking of Part 8, so Sean.
Yes.
We obviously, Part 8 is one of the best things to ever air on television.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of people be kind of down on Part 9. I thought Part 9 was just fine.
Yeah, it was great. Like, it's
really good.
It's you. Like, no matter what you followed up Episode 8 with, it would seem lesser by comparison because of how fucking good Episode 8 was. But it's like, we need to get... I think that's one of the reasons why it was smart to take a week off. It's like, you have to get back on the normal track until they decide to go insane again. Like, again, insane by this, like... We're working on a relative scale here.
Yes.
Like, a very crazy relative scale. This is a normal episode compared to Episode 8, which was not normal by any standards.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what I loved about this episode, actually, and I think somewhat self-consciously it's playing with this is a... In a normal serialized TV detective story, you'd call this the Peace Mover episode.
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of things where you have to get characters to certain places and they have to learn certain pieces of information and kind of move things around because clearly we're moving towards some kind of climax, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's the halfway point, all that stuff. But a Peace Mover episode of Twin Peaks is a special and unique thing.
Yeah.
Where we have Dougie, who apparently owns a ranch, or not Dougie, Evil Coop,
yes.
Who apparently owns a ranch and has just random women who will kiss him all over the United States, and he has Tim Roth working for him, and you have, you know, Gordon Cole going and finding the body of Major Briggs, and then you have this whole thing with the Matthew Lillard character talking about going to another dimension and meeting him, and you have apparently Major Briggs saw Bobby Briggs' entire future and left all these notes. If more Peace Mover episodes were this interesting, people wouldn't be down on them.
Yeah.
That's my takeaway.
Yeah, it's like, it is absolutely of a piece of, like, all the other episodes of Twin Peaks that is not Episode 8. It's
right.
Like, obviously it's an outlier. Yeah, it's just...
Moving the story forward, I think it's proving to me that this is a show that knows where its story is going and is very good at crafting episodes. Because this is another one where it is a Peace Mover, but every part of the cast they chose to show us all of those story points united. They were all about, other than Jerry Horn in the Woods Being High, which I just love.
I am not your foot.
We'll talk about it. Other than that, every piece of the story we touched upon was something to do with this other dimension that we are, I think, learning we're going to see more of, not less of.
Yeah.
Very clearly, yeah. I think all that Part 8 stuff wasn't just window dressing.
No, yeah, like, is, yeah, it's... It's one of the many things that I feel like we just have to say this every single time we talk about this fucking show, is just how insane it is that this show both somehow makes the Twin Peaks, like, quote-unquote mythology, the like, even more obscure than it ever was, and also somehow is, like, 100% about the Twin Peaks mythology in a way you would have never thought David Lynch would ever do.
No, no, not at all. So, I mean, let's talk about the episode. The other thing, yeah, I want to say... Part 8 was many wonderful Lynchian things. What it wasn't, it's not a particularly funny episode.
No, yeah.
It's very dark. This was a funny episode again. Hilarious. I laughed very hard. Let's talk about this. Let's first talk about, there's some intercutting here, but I'll take one thread at a time. We start with Evil Coop, picking up from last time.
I do appreciate that they just picked up basically where they left off for us to, like, center us again, because it would have been maybe cruel to have, like, had an episode or two away from Evil Coop after Part 8. There's just, like... what the fuck happened with him? It's like, this starts up with him looking extremely fucked up walking down a road.
And I love that now we're in broad daylight, so you see just how much blood is dried and caked on poor Kyle MacLachlan. And he is just, it feels like Evil Coop doesn't even notice it. He's walking down, he pulls that, like, bandana off a wood fence, and you assume he's going to wipe himself off with it, but you don't know. He gets to this ranch, and Tim Roth is there because there's a lot of celebrities in this, in this show. And Tim Roth calls him the boss man. There's this woman comes out. What I love about this whole scene is that they seem completely nonplussed by this crazy circumstance. Like, she is used to fishing a bullet out of him. He is used to him coming back from the dead. Clearly, Evil Coop has been going around building a crime empire, dying and coming back enough that his associates are not surprised by it.
Yeah, it is a good continuation of all the insane cliche crime movie world that Evil Coop has created for himself.
Yep. And then we have Cooper has this pink, like, bedazzled phone.
A fucking flip phone from, like, 2000. It's the flip phone I had when I got from, like, my freshman to junior year in high school, basically.
I think I had a similar one. Yeah, that's what it looks like. And he texts on the phone, again, with, like, the number pad. Around the dinner table, the conversation is lively. I love all of Evil Cooper's, like, code phrases. They're wonderful. And then he calls the pit boss from episode 3 in the casino, of all people.
Yeah.
This is one where I have no idea where this is going. And he just says, "Did you do it? Not yet. Better be done next time I call." That's a very mysterious scene. Don't know where that's leading. I'm not going to try to theorize.
No, yeah.
And then you have that whole thing where I think they're... Oh, yeah, after he kind of gets cleaned up, the Tim Roth character comes up and says, "How's that, boss?" "It's real good, Hutch." Love that exchange. And then he says to Hutch, "I want you to kill a warden within the next 2 days. Then I got a double header for you in Vegas. Kill him at home, at work, or on the way." His whole series of evil instructions are wonderful.
Yeah, it's like Kyle MacLachlan is so fucking good as Evil Cooper. Every time we see him, I think he just gets even better and better.
Because he's both scary and hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if he gives him the fucking phone, it's just like, "Take care of this." And then he's fucking throws the phone to the ground, and Tim Roth just shoots it with a shotgun, which is a really great way. That's a great moment to cut on. His character shooting a fucking cell phone with a shotgun.
And then there's that woman, Chantel, who is doing stuff for him, and then she leans in, and she and Evil Coop, like, violently kiss for like a minute and a half.
Yeah, it is like a full minute longer than you think is going to be when that moment starts.
I really kind of wish he would have just turned around and kissed Tim Roth, too. Because I like the idea that not only does Evil Coop have lackeys everywhere, apparently they all want to fuck him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, who wouldn't?
He's got that jacket, man.
He's got that mohawk.
He changes, like, his clothes and everything, and then he keeps the jacket. Like, he's got a different shirt, but the jacket always stays.
It's absolutely wonderful. And that's the last we see of Evil Coop in this episode. He's off to do something evil, but I love all of that.
Yeah, and now we know that Warden Murphy's got a man after him.
Yep, so that's going to be fun. I want to see more of Tim Roth in this, because he's an actor who I don't think has been in a Lynch thing before, but feels like he should have been.
Yeah.
So that's great. So then we also have Gordon, Cole, Diane, Albert, they're all on a plane. Tammy brings Cole some coffee, and then Cole gets this phone call from Colonel Davis, who we've heard from before.
Ernie Hudson.
And we have one of my favorite lines. "I don't appreciate your language one bit, Colonel. Oh, it's a place. Buckhorn, South Dakota." I love that David Lynch and Mark Frost are doing this crazy art experiment, but they'll also just make a third grade language joke. Yeah. You know? "I don't appreciate your language
one bit, Colonel."
That's great. You have these constant cut. He's having this big expository conversation about, oh, we need to go to Buckhorn, you know, all of that kind of peace mover stuff. But why it's so funny is we keep cutting back to Diane and Albert, who are both sleeping. And then Diane finally kind of stirs after all of Cole's shouting. And then Cole goes back and tells Diane about the trip to Buckhorn. And he gives her this whole thing about, you know, we need to do this. And he's got his hand on her shoulder in a slightly creepy old man way.
Yeah.
Diane is still awesome. She tells him to fuck off. And then after that whole scene is over, Albert wakes up and looks at Diane, and Diane says, or no, and then Albert says, "I know."
Yeah, yeah, I know. Fuck you, Albert. And turns over and goes back to sleep.
He's great. God bless Miguel Ferrer.
Yeah.
He's so wonderful. And then at the end of this scene, Gordon Cole gets a call from Warden Murphy that Coop has escaped, and he says, "Cooper flew the coop!"
I love, like, again, like, just, like, takes the time for the stupid pun. Just,
yep. And then in my notes, I have Dougie and then a bunch of exclamation points, all caps.
Yes.
Because we got back to Dougie.
You know, haven't seen him in a while. There's not a lot of Dougie in this episode, but it's good.
It's very good. I mean, we learn some interesting things. A lot of this episode is not necessarily us learning new things, but it's confirming suspicions.
Yeah.
And this is one we get here because there's this whole long scene at the police station. There's this very long scene with the cops. And one of the cops is the guy from The Office who, God, what's his name? I don't remember, but he plays Michael's best friend on The Office, like the asshole guy.
Yeah,
I think I have his name written somewhere in here. I'll get to it at some point. So you have all that stuff. But eventually you get this whole information that they have no information on Dougie Jones prior to 1997.
Yeah.
They say no license, passport, social security, class records, tax records, no birth certificate. Dougie has only existed for 20 years. And, of course, they float the idea of witness protection. But both they and us, we know that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Dougie Jones ain't in witness protection.
No.
Dougie Jones was made from pure
the
sex.
The only things that Dougie Jones has witnessed is things of his own making.
Indeed. Yeah. So there's some really fun moments here where, like, after all of that, I think one of the cops says something about, "Remember the Australian guy with the pliers?" And they all start laughing maniacally. And it's this shot where we're overhead on them, and there's the window, and then Janie and Dougie are out there. And out from outside, Janie just kind of slowly looks inside like, what are they laughing about? And Naomi Watts is so great.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Todd Packer is the character I was thinking of from The Office. I don't know that actor's name, but he played Todd Packer on The Office. He has this really smart idea, and I want to talk about this because it's interesting. He gets Dougie a new cup of coffee, takes the old cup, and puts it into evidence. So this is another vector by which they're going to find out it's Dale Cooper.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's going to be Dale Cooper's DNA, and at that point the FBI will be alerted. And there's a couple of vectors for this. So there's that. We have the DNA. We have the whole thing that... In Colonel Briggs' stomach later in the episode, they find the ring to Dougie Love Janie E. And we have that key from the hotel that Ben Horn has.
Yeah.
So there's at least three ways floating out there in the ether that Gordon Cole and friends, I think, can find Dale.
Also, later in this episode, when we're in Twin Peaks, they have the whole thing left to them from the major in his house in the chair that has the thing that says Cooper, Cooper. So, like, two Coopers.
Right.
So which is not definitive evidence of anything, but for Twin Peaks, it would be definitive evidence for these characters.
Yes. I don't know if we're going to get him out of Dougie Jones state anytime soon, but I do think we're in, sooner rather than later, we're going to see him interact with Gordon Cole and everyone again. You know, and I think there's going to be a confirmation that there are two Coopers. Like, everyone is starting to realize this. So, like, you know, again, this is a peace mover episode, but that's a lot of action. Like, we know something big is coming because they're going to run that DNA test. And things are going to blow up, you know? So this is coming, and I think that's interesting. Okay, so that's that whole scene with the police. Then we hear in dialogue for the first time, you know, the officer comes in, and they have the prints off the gun, and we hear the phrase, Ike the Spike.
Yes.
They finally mention Ike the Spike, who we'd only seen in credits.
Yes.
Yeah, so
I was very happy.
The little person assassin. So you know, we know they're going to go after Ike the Spike. There's a scene later. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but there's that scene later where they... go to the hotel and they arrest Ike the Spike. So that's going to be interesting. And he's got that big bandage on because apparently Cooper ripped off his hand.
Yeah, well, you remember because when he, like, the gun, there was just, like, that gross piece of flesh to the gun. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I like all of that. But one of the best scenes in the episode is the Dougie Jones scene where Dougie's sitting there. He's looking wistfully. Kyle MacLachlan is such an interesting actor. And the camera pushes in on him slowly like something's going to happen. And he's looking at an American flag.
Yeah.
And we start hearing America the Beautiful on the soundtrack, seeing it from his perspective. He keeps blinking, kind of his face unmoving. A woman walks out into his line of sight, and he kind of follows her red high heels. And then he sees that electrical outlet on the wall, which he came out of in episode 3. And he seems to recognize something. It's still mostly Lynch trolling us, I think.
Yeah, but then also I think there's something about that scene of, like, lingering on that American flag for as long as they do. Like, that was, like, really affecting in a weird way.
It is.
Because it reminds you of, like one, it's, like, anything that's, like, directly referencing Americana right now is like, a tense subject in America for obvious reasons. But then also for the character of Coop, like, obviously he was an FBI agent, like, he was an employee of the American government, like, that means something to you, it has to, and so that reference point is, like, it just, I think it's one of the many things in this that makes you think about how much time has passed between now and old Twin Peaks, and, like, how different showing that American flag and doing that in 2017 is compared to doing it in, like, 1991.
Exactly, and, you know, when people say that the Dougie Jones scenes are a bunch of teasing and nothing ever happens, things are happening. You can read it in a lot of different ways, and I think there's a blankness to it that is intentional, allowing you to read as much or as little as you want into it. But unless your expectation every time is he has to just fully wake up and go get some damn good coffee now, those moments still do affect this character, right?
Yeah.
And I think they're affecting because you do feel this stirring, and he's just still continually unable to fully connect with that thing inside him that will awaken Dale Cooper, right? Yeah. But I do think that accumulation of moments throughout the 9 episodes so far, all of them have been affecting and interesting in various ways, and I do think it's building up to, I like the idea of what is the thing that's going to wake him up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think at this point, you know, the more I kind of consider it, I don't think it's going to be just a hackneyed plot point that's going to wake him up. I think he's going to encounter something that will bring him back.
Sure,
yeah. And I think when we hit that, it's going to be personal and interesting and I think affecting for the character. And I like that it will have been built up to by all these other little things that brought stirrings. But, like, where is Dale Cooper's heart really at?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, one thing, way to read it is I think if he becomes Cooper again, it could be him going back to Twin Peaks that wakes him up. You know, right. Like, maybe that's the thing he needs to shake
him
out of.
He just needs to see some good old Douglas firs.
Exactly, yeah. That would be great if he's just, his first line back is Douglas Fir.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. And my only hope is that Naomi Watts just continues tagging along with him throughout all this. And then at the end, Cooper just decides to stay with this awesome woman and they just make a life together.
That is my greatest hope as well. It's just like she, because you know that, like, her marriage with Dougie must have been fucking terrible because it was Dougie Jones. Like, I love him, you love him, but come on. He's not the guy you want to be married to, right?
Dale Cooper is a sensitive lover.
Yeah, like, Dale Cooper is the one you want to marry. Like, I mean, they're... Oh, my God. This is all of what Twin Peaks The Return is. It's a big game of fuck, marry, kill with Dale Cooper. You fuck Dougie Jones. You marry Dale Cooper, and you kill evil Cooper. That's what this whole... It's just... That's all it is. I mean, am I right?
I think we don't need to talk about Twin Peaks anymore. I think you solved it.
There we go. I did it. I have beaten the internet. I can now write my fucking clickbait article about what I have solved Twin Peaks. The mystery box of Twin Peaks has nothing to do with numbers or any of that bullshit. It's just fuck, marry, kill.
And that's going to be the last scene as Naomi Watts is presented with this question.
Exactly. She shoots evil Coop. She fucks Dougie while she's putting the ring on Coop's finger.
All right, back to the notes. Let's see what else we got to talk about. So we got Ike the Spike gets arrested. Beautiful shot as we cut to Twin Peaks, where we have the fir trees, and it's the sun breaking through them. We pan down to the sheriff's department, and then we have an intensely odd scene between Lucy and Andy, where they are trying to buy a chair and an ottoman.
Yeah.
And we keep going, Lucy will stand up and go over to Andy and say, "Andy, I really love the beige chair." And then she sits down. And then he stands up and goes over to her and says, "And Lucy, I really love the red chair." And he sits back down. And she gets up And I really love the beige chair, Andy. And Andy hesitates for a while, finally gets up and says, I'm sorry, Pumpkey, you can get the beige chair. And then she buys the red chair. Yeah. That scene had nothing to do with anything. I loved it, and I love how little Andy and Lucy have missed a beat since 1991.
Yeah.
They are perfect as those characters still.
It's just a lovely little scene.
I love the idea that, like, Andy and Lucy are still so fundamentally themselves, but now with, like, old married life concerns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's one of the few things in Twin Peaks: The Return that feels like it's giving you that, like that fan thing for Twin Peaks to be like, yeah, like it's fun to see these characters and what these characters became after being married for like 20 years.
Yep. We do have another interesting non sequitur after that, where there's this, we go to like a mansion and some guy is running around crazily and there's a woman shouting, and then he runs into a wall covered in blood and the woman yells Johnny over and over. So I think we're supposed to assume that's Johnny Horn, who was like the mentally challenged or something brother of Audrey Horn. And he apparently has just hurt himself.
Yeah, that's what I took that to be as well.
Yeah, so this feels like a scene that, I don't know, it's clearly set up for something else and maybe didn't quite belong in this episode. But I do feel like we have to be getting to a scene with Audrey at some point.
Yeah.
Between that, and we know there's the Richard Horn character out there in the world who killed the kid. So, yeah, I think that's probably set up for that.
Yeah.
That we might see Audrey tending for her concussed brother or something like that. Not much to say about that scene.
No, yeah.
Then we have, I think, not the funniest scene in the episode, but maybe the most affecting, which is they go to Mrs. Briggs' house.
Yeah.
And so it's Bobby's mom, and Harry and Hawk are there too. And they're trying to talk about Coop and Garland Briggs' visit the day before Garland died. And so Miss Briggs says, right after Cooper left that day, Garland pulled me aside and said that one day our son Bobby and Hawk and Sheriff Truman, I didn't know it would be this Sheriff Truman, he said that they would come and ask me about Special Agent Dale Cooper. He squeezed my shoulders when he told me this. I tried to ask him what it was about, but he wouldn't say anymore. He just said that when they come to ask about Agent Cooper, you give them this. And now you're here. Would you fellas like some coffee? I love that speech. Yeah. I had to write it down. I think it's...
Yeah.
And it's it gets better because there's the whole thing where there's the chair and she activates and there's a metal rod. And then there's the line where she says, Bobby, when your father told me this, you were a very long way from where you are today. Somehow he knew it would all turn out okay. He saw this life for you. Your father never lost faith in you. And we have these constant cutbacks throughout all of this to Dana Ashbrook. And he's so good.
Yeah.
Like, Bobby has really only been in two episodes, but I love him. He's this older, wiser, more reflective Bobby, and he's really interesting, I think.
Yeah. One of the things I love about this scene is that I think it's supposed to be kind of like calling back to, for the audience, the probably like my favorite Bobby scene from the original Twin Peaks, which is when Briggs and him are in the diner and he tells him about the dream he had about Bobby and how he knows that everything's going to be all right. And then like Bobby like just starts emotionally breaking down in the diner.
Yeah.
Like this has that kind of feel to it of like somehow Garland Briggs had access to something deeper and like could see something that other people couldn't see, probably because of like Black Lodge, blah, 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 whatever the fuck it was. And I like that it's one of the things that feels like it kind of has come full circle is that Bobby is in that place and he has like this, he's this like respected police officer in Twin Peaks and has all his shit figured out and everything now.
I hope we see more of Bobby.
Yeah.
I really do in these next 9. I want to follow him home. I want to see like, you know, he's probably got a wife and kids or something. I just kind of want to see what he's made out of his life because he is, I think, a really interesting character to me as someone who was kind of this punk in the original series and has grown up. I do think it's, you know, they are, we've talked about this a lot. The things Lynch and Frost are cueing in on from the original series are so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Like, I would not have expected the Major Briggs metaphysics to be anything in the sequel series.
Yeah.
It's a huge part of it. But I love that it's a huge part of it with this character hook where they've brought back in, as you say, that interesting dynamic between Briggs and Bobby. Because you're right. Those were hugely emotional scenes in the original series. And I think to bring those back is really beautiful. And Dana Ashbrook, as I said, just very silent, but he's very good in those scenes.
Yeah.
You read a lot on him. So I love that. And then just to follow that up, because this is later, I guess, but I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, is you have that whole thing where, first you have this scene where they go back to the police station in the conference room, and douchebag cop Chad is having his lunch.
Chad.
And they tell Chad to leave, and he, of course, packs up very slowly, gets out of the room, and he asks Hawk to get the door, and Hawk just basically doesn't want to do it. They all know he's the biggest asshole.
Yeah.
They kick him out. And then they figure out, like, Bobby knows how to open it. It's like, well, we got to go back outside. Yeah. Because, of course, they do.
It's very funny.
Yep. No, it's great. But I love this whole scene. So Bobby figures out that you have to, like, throw it against the ground. It makes this weird hum. And then they're able to open it. And so they have to, it's this, like, code system. 253 yards east of Jackrabbit's Palace. Before leaving Jackrabbit's Palace, put some soil from that area in your pocket. And then 2 dates a time. It's going to be 2 days from now. So they've got this plan that they're going to go do this.
Yeah.
And Bobby recognizes Jackrabbit's Palace is an imaginary place he and his dad went to. So again, tying it back to the father-son dynamic, yeah. which I love. A beautiful scene again. And it's very exciting because basically that sounds like instructions to open a door to the Red Room or something.
Sure, yeah. You know? Something crazy.
Yeah.
And Bobby has to be there because he's the only one who knows where Jackrabbit's Palace is.
So we're going to get more of that. I love the idea of this Sheriff Truman encountering the Red Room or something.
Right.
And Hawk and all those guys. That's going to be fascinating. So, yeah. We talked about how they have the code that says Cooper. So again, a lot of plot movements. These are not the big scenes. They're the lead up to the big scenes. But I think I'm so excited for the big scenes. And again, very emotional stuff in there at the time. Okay. So then we have this long sequence in South Dakota.
Yes.
Where Gordon Cole and everyone gets there and they go to the morgue and you have the wonderful line from Diane where she's smoking. She says, I'm sorry, ma'am, you can't smoke in here. It's a fucking morgue! Fucking pansies!
Yeah.
That's just so great. And then we get one of the most surprising moments in all of Twin Peaks, I think, which is she keeps checking her phone and she gets the text from Evil Cooper.
Yeah.
Around the dinner table, the conversation is lively. That was unexpected.
Yeah. It also, it's another thing, like, there's something we skipped over in an earlier scene when they're on the plane, is she's looking at her phone, and it just has this big text on the screen that just says, blocked! And I'm like, the fuck is that? What is, it's like another, it's like, what does it even mean? What is, like, is she trying to access, like, did she steal someone's phone and she can't get into it? Or, like, I couldn't understand what the fuck that meant, blocked. I guess it was, she couldn't get a wireless signal or something because she was on a plane?
Yeah.
Who knows?
But yeah, it was funny. But like, that's troubling. Is Diane in cahoots with Evil Coop?
Is this actually evil Diane and not real Diane? Is there a Dougie Diane out there? Who knows?
Would you put it past the show to introduce that?
Who knows?
Yeah.
There's no way it happens because I said that, and there's no way I would ever be able to predict where this show is going to go in the future now.
I know. This is a scene that I think demands some speculation, but it's so hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, like, maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe that was just, like, that guy who was in her apartment earlier was, like, went to a dinner party, was texted her about, like, yeah, the conversation around the dinner table is really lively, and it was just a totally innocuous thing.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, I will say, I thought after part 7, that might be the last of Laura Dern on this. Clearly not.
No.
She's in this for the long haul.
Yeah.
And I want to explore Diane more. She's an interesting character. Yeah. So I like that. Then we go back to, so they're in the morgue, and the officer recaps this whole complicated case and everything that's happened, which I actually found valuable because I did not remember all the particulars of it.
Yeah, because it's like all the way back from episode 1.
Yes.
A long time ago.
I know. Like, this is only the second appearance of Matthew Lillard when we get there.
Yeah.
But then we have that great line from Albert. He says, what happens in season 2? And Cole says, apologies in advance for Albert. Yeah, so We look at Major Briggs' body. We learn this whole thing that William Hastings, the Matthew Lillard character, and the librarian who died, who was his lover, were researching another dimension called the Zone, and they met the Major there. We learn about that more later, but we hear about that. We have this whole great exchange with the mortician. Not to mention he was marble champion of the 6th grade. When did he lose his marbles? When the dog got his cat's eyes. I don't know what that means.
Dude, no one knows what that means.
But it was great. And then we have this whole Albert and Cole kind of try to recap the case for themselves, that Briggs should be 72 by now. Apparently he died in a fire outside Twin Peaks in some weird, suspicious government facility.
Yeah.
And now they're saying, well, wait, 25 years ago Cooper was around Briggs, and now they're both showing up in this neck of the woods. And then they get that ring out of the stomach to Dougie, love Janie E, and Gordon Cole wants to talk to William Hastings.
Yeah.
So I think something worth talking about is that, you know, the original Twin Peaks is a mystery show, at least until it's solved. And I think this show, it was hard to say, is there a core mystery at the heart of this? There is now. I think we're starting to see that all come together, that everyone is trying to solve kind of what is fundamentally the same mystery, even though it's much more complex and split up. And I think as mystery storytelling goes, I really like this.
Yeah, because it's one thing that's interesting about it is that even the audience is not 100% sure about what is the mystery that we are ultimately solving. Like, it's because it feels like it, like where everyone is going is everyone is moving towards Coop slowly but surely. But like, what will be accomplished when they get there is a big question mark.
Exactly. In between this and the next scene and everything else, we do get that great scene of Jerry Horn out in the woods, high as shit, and the weird, I am not your foot! And he goes to touch it and gets spooked. It's a really long scene. Yeah. And then he finally goes back, grabs it by both hands, and yanks
himself up. Yeah, he tries to pull himself up by his bootstraps. Yep. It reminds you that that's not physically possible.
I just love this series of shorts we're getting about high Jerry Horn.
Yeah.
And that I just imagine, like, David Lynch and the actor just went out in the woods for a day and shot some weird stuff, and they're just sprinkling it throughout episodes. But who knows? Maybe Jerry Horn, like, finds the thing that brings Cooper back or something when he's high. Like,
it's totally possible. It's it's impossible to know where that's going.
But I love it.
Yeah.
It's all great. I know.
It's a fucking amazing scene.
Speaking of amazing scenes, before they go to meet the Matthew Lillard character, we go to this long, long take of Cole and Tammy, the other FBI agent, and they join Diane, who's smoking outside.
In, like, the stairwell.
In the stairwell. And for, like, 2 minutes, the shot just holds on the three of them there. And the best part is Agent Tammy Baldwin, who has no idea how to hold herself in this between these two very weird superiors.
Yeah, and who also, like, they have known each other for years and so have this, like, weird relationship that she's not a part of.
Yeah, and I never have any sense of time watching these episodes, and I thought for sure they were going to roll credits. And that would have been so fucking funny if they just rolled credits on the three of them standing there, but they don't. Finally, what happens is Cole reaches out for Diane's cigarette and takes a drag. Tammy tries to stop him, and he says, "Hey, whoa, we used to smoke together way back when. You remember?" And it's great. Diane smiles.
I remember, Gordon.
Yep, gives her back the cigarette. It's a very good and very funny scene.
I think that was my favorite scene in the episode. There's just something about it just holding on that for that long and having the cigarette thing. It scenes like that, and then like having Jerry Horn in the woods is what's like. This episode is not disappointing to me in any way. Like has that like like you said, it's a much more funny episode, which is something we need to sort of like get back on track. But having that like these kinds of mood setters like that is just it's so. Perfect.
Yes, absolutely. So then we have, I think, kind of the showcase scene of the episode, which is the interrogation of the Matthew Lillard character, which is also a big standout scene for Agent Tammy Baldwin, who hasn't had a lot of big scenes yet, but I really like that character. Yeah. And she interrogates him, and he is like completely broken wreck at this point, just sobbing. He's at the beginning of the scene, he's going, "Get out of my head, get out of my head," over and over. I think he's pretty disturbed.
Yeah, he has lost his marbles too.
Yes, but then we learn this whole story, and he explains that they figured he and the librarian who was murdered, and he's accused of murdering her, learns that if they went to a certain place at a certain time, they could enter different dimensions, and that's how they met the Major. Apparently the Major was hibernating in this other dimension, and he asked for important numbers, and those numbers are coordinates. So that answers kind of this long-standing mystery in the show so far, which is all these fucking numbers. Yeah. And that Evil Coop wanted the numbers too, and that's the coordinates.
Yeah.
Or something. So that's interesting.
And maybe those coordinates are basically the same thing that now Bobby and the Sheriff and everyone has in Twin Peaks, because
I know
that sounds like a similar scenario.
Yep. So apparently Matthew Lillard had to look at a secure military database for them, and then Ruth wrote them on her hand. He goes through all this. They brought back the numbers, and then something terrible happened. He mentions a caveman pushed down himself and like asked him his wife's name, and then Lillard just starts yelling that he did not kill Ruth. And we get a sense that it was probably those same ghostly figures from Part 8 and other parts who killed Ruth. And then he talks about how after that... Briggs started floating into the sky, said Cooper, right before he disappeared, and then he was gone, and then Ruth was dead, and then he woke up in his bed, and it's like crazy stuff, but we do get a sense of what the timeline was with all of this.
Yeah.
That he wasn't like possessed by Bob or anything, they went to this other dimension and something terrible happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think there's another great part of the scene though, which is where Matthew Lillard has this little monologue where he says, "We were so happy together. We were going to go to the Bahamas. We were going to scuba dive. We were going to drink mixed drinks on the beach." And it's this amazing monologue because I did not know whether to laugh or cry.
I was laughing at it at some point. Like, it's just he's sobbing. It's just like, "We're going to drink mixed drinks on the beach."
And we're gonna go scuba diving. I've always wanted to go scuba diving. But you know what I mean? Where, like, yeah. David Lynch does this. That's not like a new David Lynch scene. He does this where he pushes the emotions so high that your heart simultaneously breaks and just inflates with laughter.
Yeah.
You know? Because, yeah, you do want to laugh because it's ridiculous, but it's also like, this, you sense this guy's pain. It's crazy. And then they undercut the scene with Albert going, "Fruitcake, anyone?"
Yeah.
Because Albert's a jerk.
Albert is a jerk. But I love him.
But clearly all of this is connected.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no coincidence that they tell us all the Briggs stuff in the same episode that over in Twin Peaks they're learning about the Briggs stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, very good storytelling.
Also feels like it's maybe, like, who knows if we're ever actually going to, like, directly make the connection again, because it has been a very long time, but, like, the New York stuff from the pilots of, like, the weird box, that feels like maybe this is also leading to something with that as well, because that was clearly them trying to access an alternate dimension in some crazy way.
I agree. I don't know if we'll see the same thing in New York,
but
I think all this is, it's going to tie together. It really is amazing how much of this narratively holds together, when I think after the first four episodes, we thought none of it might. You know?
Yeah, it just seemed like this insane, sprawling, like, aimless thing, and then it is actually, like, really carefully constructed with all these elaborate moving pieces that are, like, just pushing all these different characters in totally disconnected areas, revolving back around to finding Coop at some point. And there's something really amazing about that. It's again, as you just think about what old Twin Peaks was and what this is and how little of this is actually set in Twin Peaks, it's just crazy.
I love it. We end with a couple of non sequitur scenes, I would say. We have one scene in Twin Peaks back at the inn. What's that inn called? The Twin
Pines? Oh, the Great Northern?
Great Northern, yeah. Great Northern. And we have Ben Horn and Ashley Judd. Beverly is her character's name. They're hearing that sound again, still looking for it. Kind of a repeat of that scene from a couple weeks ago. And I love this exchange, though. It's kind of a mesmerizing tone. Yes, the ring out of a monastery bell has the same quality, sort of otherworldly. And then it switches into that soap opera quality where they, like, embrace and they start touching each other. And then he says, "Beverly, I can't do this. I don't know why it is. It's because you're a good man, Ben." I like that scene. Yeah. I don't know where any of that is leading, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I like whenever we can visit it on Ben Horn.
Yes.
He's fun.
And then we have a last scene at the Roadhouse.
Yeah.
And we have these two strung-out women drinking. And one of them says, "You know that zebra's out again?" And they just start laughing. And there's a lot of weird scenes here. Apparently one of them got in trouble. There's some kind of food job. One of them has, like, some kind of rash under her arm. She's, like, constantly scratching.
God, that was so gross.
But it felt like we were leading towards some sort of body horror that didn't quite happen.
Yeah, I kept on thinking she's going to, like, rip her armpit out or something. It's like, God, it was disgusting.
It was, yes.
But it led to nothing.
It led to nothing.
Thank God.
Do you think we see more of that?
I have no idea. Like, it feels like they, because there have been a number of scenes vaguely like that so far that are just like weird random young people in Twin Peaks, usually at the bar, and like just doing weird shit. Like, there's like that one with like the guy who kind of like assaulted that girl there, like in the scene and stuff like that.
Well, that was Richard Horn, so that was set up.
But it's like, but it just feels like those things are kind of like disparate right now, and who knows. They are definitely, it feels like they must come together because it feels like everything is coming together, but like they are,
I think,
fishing far lines right now with those.
I do feel like there's some kind of sense, and I think there was a larger philosophical conversation around it in part 8, of some corruption out there in the world. And I think wherever this is going, I think, I almost feel like this is on some kind of anime trajectory where they're going to solve whatever the actual mystery is, and then they're going to meet a god and fight it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think there's going to be the normal climax and then the crazy climax. And I think we're going to see both.
Sure, yeah. We get the true ending of Twin Peaks.
It does feel like that's kind of the direction we're heading. But we do have all these teen characters out in the world. We have the Amanda Seyfried character and her druggy boyfriend. We have the Jane Levy character, who was the one with the group of girls who got assaulted by Richard Horn.
Yeah.
And then we have these two girls. So yeah, there is this like teenage subculture that is much darker than the teenagers in original Twin Peaks.
Oh yeah.
So, who knows? I did love, after this, the final, the performance, the three women singing and playing electronic instruments. Their band name is Au Revoir Simone.
Which there you go.
I actually very much enjoyed that performance.
Yeah. I thought it was a really good visual, too, with, like, the three of them all, like, kind of standing in parallel with all their, like, keyboards forming, like, almost like a line on the screen. It was a good shot.
I want David Lynch to, like, just go make an indie concert movie.
Yeah.
He's really good at that.
He basically is. If you just cut the ending of all these episodes together, you have one. There you go.
Again, DVD bonus. features. Yeah. Just cut it all together. No, very good. I was utterly satisfied with this episode, Sean. Yeah,
me too. This show continues to just be utterly stunning. Like, it's just...
Yeah.
For all the reasons we've said of, like, it is weirdly this compelling, intricately constructed mystery, and then it also just has these incredible, weird scenes and moments of Coop staring at the American flag, and then, like, following the heels, and then, like, resting on the electrical outlet, and somehow David Lynch managing to just make this empty... or, like, not occupied electrical outlet seemed like the most terrifying fucking thing in the world. Or just three characters standing in a stairwell for, like, 5 minutes, and then one of them starts smoking. Like, it's just...
It's amazing. We're at the halfway point now.
Yes. Yeah, we are.
9 episodes behind us, 9 episodes ahead of us. Can't believe we still have 9 to go. I mean, if the first 9 were this crazy, what's left to come? And I don't know if
maybe you hit it on the head. Maybe it ends with them fighting God. I don't know.
It could at this point. Like, they could meet, you know, Jaldaboa from Persona 5 and fight him. It'd be great.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it is the question that I feel like maybe when we finally get it answered, that's when the world ends, is what the fuck does the last episode of this thing look like? If we've had things like episode 3 and episode 8 and, like, the insanity that this show is willing to go into... What does it look like at the end? What is this last episode?
But I'm so curious about, you know, more than just... Because I know we're going to get more weird aesthetic, artistic experiences, right? And experiments. But I'm also almost more curious at this point of, like, clearly there's a coherent narrative being woven. Where does that lead? Like, I'm actually much more invested in that than, frankly, I ever was in original Twin Peaks, which is so much less about, I think, that overall narrative thrust.
Yeah.
So...
For me, the big question is... At what point does Dougie Jones become Cooper, or does that ever happen? Because I'm still not fully convinced that it does. I think there's actually a reasonable chance that that never really happens.
I think there's kind of different zones. I think there is definitely a reasonable chance, like betting odds, that he doesn't. I think there is an even greater chance that it's in episode 18.
Yeah, right.
And it's like the last scene. I do think there's probably the most likely thing is we'll get some of it at some point. But how wonderful is it they've kept it up for half the series?
Yeah.
Like, they are pissing off so many people.
It is. And although, I feel like my Twitter has calmed down a little bit now. After episode 8, I legitimately think there are a lot of people that jumped ship. That was, like, the point where it's, like, you accepted it or you didn't. And then, like, if you jumped off, you have jumped off.
I think also it was the 2-week break kind of missed. Because I actually forgot it was on, too. And I was reminded on Twitter and then rushed to go watch it. So... Which was a wonderful surprise. I had no expectation of watching Twin Peaks. It was great.
Right.
No, I mean, but let's take a look back a little bit, because now we're at the halfway point. 9 episodes is a lot. Frankly, this is the length of a lot of TV seasons now.
Uh-huh.
It's 9 or 10 episodes. You know, who knows what is left? If the rest of this season was just Dougie Jones staring at a wall while paint dried,
yes,
this would still be one of the greatest things to ever air on American television.
Yeah, I mean, that maybe would push it over the edge to be the greatest. Who would know? I mean, I would have my faith that he would somehow make it amazing.
I think, you know, I've seen some of the critical reflection on this. I think the people who love this are becoming, especially after part 8, more emboldened to just say, no, this is not fan service for us or anything. This is an artistic accomplishment. And I want to bang the drum for that, too.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the best, if not, like, it could be, like, the best TV show I've ever seen. Like, it's insane.
Like, to say it's the best TV show of the year is obvious. And I think it's, frankly, if I start reading top 10 lists at the end of this year where it's like, the Americans was, fuck off. The Americans isn't that good. And no, it's not more interesting than Twin Peaks. But it's like, I almost want that to start being the critical consensus, because I think... saying it's the best TV show of the year is, like, too small.
Mm-hmm.
It is the cinematic filmmaking accomplishment of this year. And that means for in a TV, in a movie theater, whatever, I do think this is the accomplishment of this year so far. And I can't imagine anything else will be better. And I feel like they should give it both Oscars and Emmys.
Them both at it. Like, that's what I was thinking about. Like, what the fuck do the Emmys look like this year? Like, with this, do you think this...
Well, this will be in the miniseries category.
Okay.
And I think it'll do well in nominations, at least, because the whole industry loves Twin Peaks.
Okay, yeah.
At least the original. There's so much respect out there for Lynch. Like, don't forget, Lynch does have a Best Director nomination for Mulholland Drive.
Right.
And that's not a movie that got a lot of, you know, mainstream appeal at the time. But, you know, these industries I think, respect David Lynch because he's been an inspiration to everybody working in the medium. So I think it'll at least get some nominations. I would love if we could bang the drum for Kyle MacLachlan getting a Best Actor.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's kind of what I've been thinking about as well.
He deserves that. If David Lynch doesn't win a directing Emmy for this, like, what the fuck are they even doing? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Because like you said, he should win it for the fucking Academy Awards for Episode 8 at the very least.
Yeah, like, so there's a lot of things like that. You know, I think I could very easily imagine some of the higher profile guests like Naomi Watts getting attention, but I say this should be eligible for the miniseries. Its length might put it into the drama series. I don't know, like, because they've changed the miniseries rules a lot, where they let the shows that aren't in any way miniseries, but they just redo their cast every year and somehow they get in the miniseries category. Since they changed that, some of those rules have changed. But 18 episodes, I think I've heard it'll be in miniseries next year, but. Like, or is it going to be eligible this year? I actually don't know because it's taking so long to air.
Yeah.
But we'll see. It's that's all. The award stuff is going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I'm just curious what, like, the rest of the world is going to think about this thing.
Yeah.
Like, because it is, I think, like you said, the people who love it are really banging that drum. And it just makes me wonder, like, the people who haven't seen it or, like, have watched it and have not gotten into it, like, how polarizing will this thing be by the time it is said and done?
I do think wherever it's eligible for the Emmys, I think it'll get at least some nomination love just because, again, there's that industry respect for Lynch. And I think there's enough artists voting on these things that they might not even watch all 18, but they'll see the first two episodes and be like, well, this deserves cinematography or something, right. You know? But I am very curious in that. I'm so curious to see where it goes. I think we need to take a step back every couple of weeks to remind ourselves nothing like this has ever happened in TV or film.
Yeah.
This is a convergence between mediums. This is a unprecedented business arrangement. This is an auteur getting licensed to do whatever they want in a way that so rarely has happened in the history of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I think it is an all-time achievement, what we're seeing happen every week. Even in an episode like this that is definitely not the most exciting episode of Twin Peaks. But it's great. It's a piece of the whole. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's just, it feels like in every single way, it is a caliber above everything else.
Yeah.
That's out there right now.
You know, and I've seen, you know, we've said this a little bit. Other people are saying, like, by the end, this not only will probably be better than original Twin Peaks, this could be the best thing David Lynch has ever done. This might be the purest thing he's ever done. You know, I read this great piece by Matt Zollerseitz, the critic, on him saying, hey, Twin Peaks is the best show on TV right now. And one of the things he said is, I guess he interviewed at a TV festival David Chase, who's the creator of The Sopranos. So one of the, you know, godfathers of this era of TV.
Yeah.
And just casually asked him, you know, do you think this new Twin Peaks by the end might be as good as the original Twin Peaks? And David Chase says, it's already better.
Yeah.
And he just said that, like, off the cuff, like, no, it's already, like, look at it. And I do kind of, like, I think they're very different things and hard to compare. And for its era, you cannot understate the value of original Twin Peaks. But it is like, this is on a different artistic level of risk and reward, I think.
I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you always have to keep in mind that technically this is not done, but I would be, like, shocked if this somehow took, like, a creative dump at the second half or something like that. Like, there's no reason why it ever would. But you do have to also, like, if you were thinking about comparing it with original Twin Peaks, it's important to keep in mind that, like, half of original Twin Peaks is fucking terrible.
Yes.
So, it's like, Twin Peaks is just something that, like, old Twin Peaks is something where, while I love that show a lot, like, so much of it is not good enough that, like, I don't think I would put it on, like, my top 10 TV shows, if, like, that old Twin Peaks, because so much of it is bad that, like, I would not want to rewatch all Twin Peaks again. I think I'm done. Yeah. Like, I would watch season one of Twin Peaks and, like, maybe some of my favorite episodes from season two. I would never watch all of old Twin Peaks again.
Yeah, no, I understand, but I do think if we look at the career arc, when you have old Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, and this, that's his magnum opus, right?
Oh, yes, yeah.
That is his grand tapestry, and it's beautiful. So we will be back next week. We will talk more Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
I don't know what else we'll talk about exactly.
There will be something else, I'm sure.
There will be other things. Maybe we'll get a 13th Doctor announcement.
Maybe that Han Solo movie will get a third director. Who knows?
Who knows? They've finished shooting the Christmas special. They've cast the Doctor. I want to know who it is. I'm annoyed. No, I'm kidding.
Maybe it's Ron Howard.
Oh, God.